Tonight on The Download, author and editor of Boing Boing, Cory Doctorow. From the restaurant Oriole, Noah Sandoval, and our first ever Guess the Accent segment with Ted McClellan. Now, here's your host, a man who hopes Comey's hearings gets picked up for a full season, Justin Kaufman.
With the ratings, you would think that all the networks would be on the line saying, we'll give you eight more. We'll give you a season and a half with an option for a third. The only thing is that the network would request a couple changes. To make it a successful show, they need to add a babbling baby to the Comey hearings. Oh, wait, I already have that. John McCain. What a morning, huh? What a morning, but what an evening here in Chicago. It's The Download. I'm with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Justin Kaufman, 720 WGN. We got a great show lined up for you tonight. What a hearing, huh? Did you watch? Did you make popcorn, Pete? You a popcorn kind of guy, 9 o'clock in the morning?
Oh, yeah, I'm watching. I went to the pub.
You played in shops.
Waited in line.
The question I had is because it was nonstop. There were no commercials throughout it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that, like, did they have to get, you know, whenever they transition to a different senator or what have you, did the DJ at the pub, did they play some hip hop or something just to keep the flow going?
Like during the commercials of the game, they put up, they should have.
It's like every time they went back to the chairman, they're like, da 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 da. I watched it as well, and I found out quickly that I watched it with my wife this morning. My son was home sick, so we had, you know, a bunch of stuff we had to figure out, but we were watching it, and after every time Comey talked, I go, oh, that's important. You know why that's important? She's like, shh. Like, I realize, not unlike sitcoms, shows, sporting events, or whatever, I like to talk through it.
Oh, yeah.
And I realized quickly that was not going to be accepted or mm-hmm. tolerated. So it got less interesting. Not being able to go, what, during the Comey hearings kind of ruined it for me. Keeping quiet, keeping my thoughts to myself. I'm like, man, I wish I had a talk show.
Every time I look at Comey, I always think, like, he's so tall.
Yeah, right? It's a great picture, I think, in the New York Times where he's coming in and he's flanked by a couple people. He's like, he's
like
got
6'10".
He seriously
something.
Has like 6 inches on the people that are walking him in. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's the end of the day, so it's also one of the problems is, not unlike CNN, which still has breaking news on the mm-hmm. scroll, mm-hmm. across the scrawl. Across, which I love. I mean, it happened at 9 o'clock this morning, and it was already, we already got the written testimony the day before.
Yeah.
I don't know if this constitutes as breaking news. Maybe, just maybe, they got rid of the scrawl guys, and so now they're just like, you know what, we only have breaking news. Maybe we don't have any other. We lost it. Like the developing guys on break.
That's just there. They can't do anything. They're hustling behind the scenes. Like, we got to get that breaking news off the TV.
How do we get it off the TV? Like, nobody can take that down? I mean, it'll be bare. If we take the whole thing down, no one will know what they're watching.
They had, when I watched it on CNN, and then, as soon as it's over, they have an outside panel, like Wolf Blitzer,
right,
and John King, and like three other people.
Some partisans.
Like five people.
Yeah. What?
And then inside, with Wolf Blitzer, Anderson Cooper, excuse me, they had 9 people.
On one panel?
On one panel.
Wow. I give credit, because my son stayed home today. The minute that the hearing was over, we were to some, like, cartoon. It was cartoon time, and I was like, I actually had a head turn where I'm like, is this what's on after the hearings on ABC? And they're like, no, we switched the channel. I'm like, oh, I thought maybe they were going back. I don't never watch this.
Daytime shows.
I thought maybe they were showing Smurfs reruns on ABC now. I don't know. Well, we got a great show lined up for you tonight. I'm excited. We're going to talk about, think about these topics tonight. I'm very excited about the topics. We're going to talk about the free and open internet. We're going to talk about what the city is doing to desegregate and integrate Chicago neighborhoods. We're going to talk about whether or not Chicago's heading for a news monopoly. Talk about fine dining restaurants. Noah Sandoval will be here. And if that's not enough, we're going to judge your accents. Ted McLellan's going to be here. I'm so excited. We had him on a couple months ago for his book, How to Speak Midwestern, and we were kind of, I think on air, we were kind of joking about the idea this would be a great thing. And there is somewhere in the world, I think this exists, where people can call in and mm-hmm. you can evaluate your accent, and the person on the air is like, you are from Pittsburgh. You know, that's the idea, but we're going to see what we can do with the regional accents.
Can he do, like with Chicago, and, you know, there's tons of neighborhoods.
Yeah,
can
right.
he do, like, oh, that's a Mount Greenwood guy.
I wonder.
Oh, that's a Norwood
he's
Park
already
guy.
Reached out to me. He's like, he might, you know, he's nervous about it because it'll be the first time for him to actually be on the hot seat. You know, he's an author. He gets a chance to and the book is great. How to Speak Midwestern is great. Mm-hmm. It really gives you the consonants, the breakdowns, the vowels, why it's this way, where the ethnicities came from to certain parts of the Midwest. But I don't think anywhere in his repertoire has he put headphones on and listened to, yeah, hey, my name's Gary.
Yeah.
You know, and like have to pick it out. So we'll have some fun with it, though.
Yeah.
I'm excited. I like living on the edge.
Yeah, give him a hard time when he gets it wrong.
That's right. And we'll give away some pizza tonight, too. We'll do that in the 10 o'clock hour. 312-981-7200. But like I said, we got a great show lined up tonight. Cory Doctorow's here, one of my favorite journalists, editor of Boing Boing, one of my favorite sites. I'm very excited. He's in for LitFest. He wrote a novel. Not only a great book, but awesome to be able to have him in studio. He has been an advocate and an activist for a free and open internet for years. We'll talk about what that even means in this day and age. But Cory Doctorow tonight. So exciting. All right, news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. So has anyone given James Comey a sitcom deal yet? He's probably the most watched FBI director since the show Catching Up with J. Edgar Hoover. That's not a show? Well, it should have been. A huge must-watch event went down on Capitol Hill today as senators grilled slash lobbed questions to James Comey about his meetings with President Trump. Comey reiterated that he felt that Trump was ordering him to let the Michael Flynn investigation go and that there was, quote, patronage involved in the president asking if he wanted to keep his job and loyalty, whatever. What does any of this mean? Well, some interpret it as a clear-cut case of the president trying to obstruct justice. I'm not really sure what justice means here anyway. And some say, well, that's just Trump. He's a bully who doesn't know any better. But the more important thing is that Hillary emails. Yes. Which I digress. If the Republican leadership, and this is what Congressman Ryan was talking about, tries to sell us on Donald Trump's naivete when it comes to investigations and politics in the White House. And on the other hand, they say that Clinton was cunning and she knew what she was doing with emails. Totally bogus, right? Regardless of what party line you toe, you think Trump has never dealt with an investigation to his business dealings before? If you paint him as ignorant as to the way the world works, why don't you afford the same cover to a grandma who doesn't know how to work a BlackBerry? Right? Republican senators just enough to bring up Clinton emails so that at least some choices for the scrawl operator at CNN. It's like, should I just Comey? Do I go with Loretta Lynch? Do I say breaking? Of course I say breaking. Has to be breaking, but I don't know what to choose. Now, what color is the font? Is it black? Is it white? I don't know. I know one thing for sure. I think America is ready for a new day without James Comey. I hope this is the last we see of him. I feel like whenever Comey shows up on my television screen, our country dies a little, right? But Senator John McCain, more, please. Babbling. I love it. I smell a spinoff. Let's get some hearings where John McCain's up on the podium. All right, moving on. What else? So hard to move on. Comey wants to draw me back in. Notes and cars, scribble. Unclassified on purpose. No, we need to move on. While this was going on in the Senate, the House quietly passed a bill that would roll back many of the regulations put on the financial industry after they tanked the economy back in 2008. The financial industry responded by ordering mortgages for everybody and bet against themselves defaulting. And then had a huge Roman-themed party where they drank liquid gold out of foreclosed chalices. So now what? Do we sit tight and wait for The Big Short 2? I mean, who doesn't love a sequel? And to be fair, the financial industry hated these regulations. They said they were bad for business, which again, sounds like something said by people who don't like to follow the rules. Great for skateboarders, not so great for bankers, right? Springfield got back to work today, or not. They had hearings in the House so that people who were affected by the budget impasse could tell lawmakers just that. So not really working towards a budget, just complaining about the lack of one. Okay. The worst part, the people who drove to Springfield to testify, you're not getting reimbursed for your mileage. Just if they told you there was lunch involved, there shouldn't have been lunch. The Trib piece about property tax appeals is what we should be talking about. Great series. It takes on how more affluent Chicagoans are appealing their property taxes and paying less while poorer communities pay straight up on the dollar. And the ugly part is that Speaker Madigan does tax appeals as his side job. So how do we fix the appeal system? Well, Speaker Madigan would have to change it in the House. Really? I mean, I rarely went to my ethics class in college because it was so early morning, but I definitely skimmed enough of the textbook to know that there's a conflict there, right? Is it just me? It can't just be me. In weather, well, the hits keep on coming. A little overcast today. That's it. The dream's over. I'm moving to Mexico. I knew it. I knew the summer was ending. Although, hey, you heard Rob's weather report. Hottest weekend in 11 months coming up. Or not. It's the weather. Probably 50. Didn't we talk about this, Pete? Today was supposed to rain. It never did. In sports, oh boy, Cubs shortstop Addison Russell and being investigated on domestic abuse accusations. To be clear, it's not criminal, but based on some social media posts from friends of his wife. Russell put out a statement saying the allegations are false. He's not in tonight's lineup. More to come on that story for sure. I'd say this would be the kind of thing that would mess with the lovable Cub image, but two words, Aroldis Chapman. The Cubs have a big game tonight that will go a long way to testing how good this year's squad is. It's a showdown with the Colorado Rockies, who alongside the Arizona Diamondbacks are the biggest surprises so far this season in baseball. The Rockies are stacked with talent. Although, you know what? Beyond Cargo, I'm having a hard time naming another guy. Who's playing for the Rockies these days? Larry Walker? Larry Walker still playing first? Walt Weiss? Dante Bichette? Is he out and right? What about a Jeff Parrott? Is Jeff Parrott still coming out of the bullpen? God, please tell me that this game and don't ever tell me this game's getting old because there's still about 25 teams out there. We're doing this all year long. Also, something to watch, Kyle Hendricks heads to DL with right hand tendonitis. Ouch. What does that mean? That's the last thing you want, right? Your pitcher's hitting the shelf. Cubs hoping for a minimum stay. Sox are in Tampa tonight. Who cares? Oh, my Lord. Did you see the last 2 minutes of the NBA Finals last night? Well, I blinked, literally, and the Warriors rattled off 11 points to beat the Cavs. Whew. I don't know, man. I have a hard time with this LeBron-MJ comparison because it was a different era. I get it. But there was never a time where the Bulls lost like the Cavs did last night. Not too many last-minute playoff collapses on MJ's resume. So it's settled. Also, it's the feel-good story of the year that Kevin Durant worked so hard for 4 months to be in this moment. Come on. Afterwards after the game, they're talking about this is his time, his moment. Really? Since you signed with the Golden State Warriors 6 months ago? Give me a break. Tonight, the Predators and the Penguins, and I'm not talking about a National Geographic channel. Nope, although there are frozen catfish involved, always. Talking Stanley Cup Final Game 5, big one. And the Bears, well, they practiced again today with Sanchez down, Mark Sanchez. Why not see if we can get Colin Kaepernick to come to town? Oh, that's right, because everyone in the league is blacklisting him for taking a knee during the national anthem. Got it. I just didn't know that was coordinated. Got it. Pretty ridiculous that Connor Shaw has a job and Colin Kaepernick does not. All right. That's what I say to that. All right, that's the carryout for June 8th, 2017. Our paper bags are coming pre-greased. So just want to do that so your order looks really cool on the street, right? All right, coming up, we'll talk a little bit about desegregation. Also, Cory Doctorow will be my guest at the big table tonight. We'll talk about his new novel, Walk Away. That's all coming up tonight on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. Yeah? How are you doing?
You ready for some frozen catfish tonight?
Absolutely.
You throw it on the old ice if the Predators can make something happen.
We can do it. We can do it.
Although you're a Pittsburgh guy, so.
But it is in Pittsburgh, and they've already jumped out to a 1-0 lead. So, yeah. Yeah.
You know, this I like that. I got to say, you know, after kind of being let down by the NBA Finals, the whole NBA playoffs, you had it, hit it on the head, man. The NHL playoffs are where it's at, the Stanley Cup.
There is so much parity in the NHL, and it was after the lockout year where they lost an entire season, but they brought into place an economic, framework that really works for all the teams. And hey, just listen to Charles Barkley.
Yeah, I mean, right.
No bigger NHL fan out there right now than former NBA All-Star Charles Barkley.
What? The NHL didn't just bring in Kevin Durant to win a championship? All right. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up tonight in the 8 o'clock hour. We got a great show tonight. I'm so excited. Cory Doctorow is going to be here. Novelist. He wrote a new book called Walk Away, but he's also an editor at Boing Boing. We'll talk about a free and open internet, and that's really what he's been about. And he has been an activist and an advocate and a champion. He's been a keynote speaker at all the conferences, the hacker conferences around the world. So we'll talk to him about copyright, digital rights management, all the fun stuff. We'll talk about all that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Also tonight, Ted McClellan's going to be back. How to Speak Midwestern. We're going to try and guess your accent. That's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Tonight, we continue our ongoing conversation about the region we live in, and of course, Chicago. One of the issues we've dedicated a few segments to in the past couple months has been segregation. The Metropolitan Planning Council put out a big study about the cost of living apart, not just the people that are living in segregated neighborhoods, but for all the taxpayers in the area. And it has proven over and over that a diverse and integrated city, town, or suburb can lead to a better economic opportunity for all. But if everyone agrees in that statement, well, what can be done about it? Tonight, we start talking about some of the solutions that are popping up to tackle segregation. Studio with me with some examples of how our government hopes to tackle the issue is Marisa Novara. She's a director with Metropolitan Planning Council. She wrote a recent piece about 4 steps the city has done recently to desegregate. Great to have you back. Good to see you, Marisa. Thanks for being
Justin.
Here.
Good to be here.
All right, so let's get into this. We talked a lot about segregation being, something that is holding the city back, and it's great to start talking about the solutions. When we'll get into the 4 specific steps. But are you surprised that the city has started to move in a direction that sort of takes a look at this issue as something that they need to address?
You know, I think it's something we're seeing coming under the previous administration. Under the Obama administration, this push was even coming from the federal government. And so in some ways, some of the changes that we see were first put in place at the state level, actually. Our state housing development authority was the first to put in place some guidelines to say, you know, we expect to see affordable housing across all neighborhoods, not only in low-income neighborhoods, but in low-income neighborhoods, high-income neighborhoods, and everything in between. And that comes from a federal law that we sort of took our time implementing. That was actually part of the Fair Housing Act 50 years ago. We just never enforced it until the Obama administration. So
it takes about 50 years.
Yeah, for people to get their heads around this stuff. So Obama really, President Obama really pushed that, and we started to see some movement coming from the federal government, and that trickled down, I think, first to the state level, and now we're definitely seeing some push for that across the board in the city of Chicago and in other parts of the region.
When you're dealing with big societal issues like segregation, obviously this is kind of an ignorant question in the sense that how much do political forces help that or get in the way of that? I mean, we talk about a new administration that's in that may not have the same values as the last, and you talked about it being 50 years since the Fair Housing, and I'm sure that has been interpreted in many different ways by different presidents and different administrations. How much does political beliefs and values get in the way of something like integration or desegregation?
Well, I would say it's 99% of the issue in some cases. I mean, it's really a question of, in some ways, what you believe to be the role of government and versus what you believe to be the role of much smaller, either individuals or groups of people to make decisions, right? And I think something that we see out of the current administration is a view that perhaps having some opinions about how where people should be able to live, that's viewed with some suspicion. And I think that's unfortunate because in actuality, the way that cities like Chicago became set up the way that they are in terms of the high level of racial and economic segregation is that people made incredibly deliberate decisions about where people could live.
Right.
And nothing about that was organic or happened by accident. And so to act as if it's somehow now problematic to make some very deliberate decisions to change that is, you know, at best disingenuous and at worst a lot worse.
Yeah, right. It always makes me think about, you know, as we've had the conversations you were on a couple months ago and even Alden and others come in and talk about the cost of segregation, what it does to the city, that you recognize over time that more and more people agree with that. They'll agree with the concept that we have we have set up inequality. And I think on paper, everybody's like, let's go ahead and tackle that. But actually implementation, it starts to crumble the sort of consensus across the board that this is an issue or this should be an issue that should be prioritized.
Well, that's right. And I think something that is true of when we set up a system, whether that's school funding, whether it's mortgage interest deduction, anything of that sort, when you set up a system and then later you realize that there were incredibly inequitable results from that system, it becomes very, very hard to change because people have become accustomed to feeling that it's their right to receive something, right? And so change is very, very hard, even when you're able to show factually that change would be in someone's best interest. You know, we all don't operate. We operate a lot as human beings on emotion and fear, not so much on facts.
Well, what I love about the Metropolitan Planning Council work that you've done around this issue of segregation is that you can start to see government, City of Chicago, come up with some things that are addressing the issues that were laid out in some of the stuff that you guys have put out over the last past year. Let's get into that.
Okay.
The first one you have here is really planning and development. A new plan for the city, essentially.
Right. And, you know, this sounds, it was pretty low key. It was kind of rolled out very quietly, but it's actually has pretty big implications. So this is a draft plan that the Department of Planning and Development at the city level has floated to say, you know, when we review proposals for affordable housing development, we are now saying that we expect to get proposals that provide affordable housing across the entire city. And we're proactively seeking that. We are saying that we expect to see this across the board. The way that it's worked in the past has largely been that our affordable housing that's funded through the city has largely been on the south and west sides of the city, right? And that has some historical reasons that those are the neighborhoods that traditionally had the strongest community development corporations. Those community development corporations were set up to fight the deindustrialization, disinvestment, racism. And so, of course, those groups are invested in building in those neighborhoods, and as well they should, and as those neighborhoods have benefited from that. And as someone who worked at one of those organizations in North Lawndale on the west side, hats off, and it's very important work. It just should not be the only place that we provide affordable housing. So with this move, the city has said we expect to see investment even in stronger markets where there may be more resistance, where there may be political resistance, as we've seen recently in other parts of the city. That's right. And it may be harder to pull off financially because the land, you know, may be more expensive.
Well, I was going to say,
on.
There's always going to be pushback and political pushback we've talked about. And I do. We will get to residential pushback as well. But there's also development pushback in a certain way. The real estate community is like, we don't want to give up this area for affordable housing because we make money off of this stuff. The more the land is, the more we want to sell to people who can afford that land.
Right. And that's where I think it's important that we have some citywide goals in mind. Right. The city has said that when you need something from the city, if you need city land, city money, or a zoning change, then you are required to put some affordability on site. And there are some aldermen who have upped the ante on that and said, you know, you can't just do 2.5% on site. You need to do the full 10% of these units on site because it matters in my neighborhood,
right?
And that's where I think it's important that, in my mind, that's an important role of government, is to say it's not just what someone thinks should be on their block. It's not just what a developer wants to build. It's what do we need as a city in order to be a thriving place?
You know, Marisa Navarro is in studio. She's the director with the Metropolitan Planning Council. We're talking about some of the things that the city of Chicago has done to steps that have taken to desegregate the city, which has long been known to be one of the most segregated cities in America. We saw this next one, you know, it really kind of played out in the newspapers, but seven aldermen got together and said, we're on the hook for our neighborhoods and what we do for the affordable housing. This was kind of unprecedented for them to come together and say, we are committed to affordable housing. We're committed for our neighborhoods to be desegregated.
That's right. This was seven North and Northwest Side aldermen whose wards are not traditional, powerhouses of affordability. And they spoke in really plain language. We were the only non-aldermanic entity to speak in that press conference. And they spoke in pretty clear language. They said, we understand that for far too long, aldermen on the North and Northwest sides have done far too little to open our communities to low-income and minority families. And Chicago's history of racism has left a legacy of exclusion we must respond to today. And, you know, I found that a pretty extraordinary level of self-responsibility and recognition of the need to be part of the solution. And I say that as someone, you know, as you noted, we've been working on the issue of segregation for quite a while now. And I can't tell you how many people in leadership positions during that time have said, you know what, addressing segregation is not my job. And so it's quite refreshing to have a group of people stand up and say, it is my job. It's not, I can't solve it all myself, but I can do some things and I need to pledge to do that.
And that moves right into the third one. And this is the story that we've been talking about in this show and on this radio station in Chicago for the last couple months in Jefferson Park, a push for an affordable housing unit or a building that would have affordable housing. And there has been residential pushback. And a lot of the old tropes about what, you know, bringing people of lower income to the neighborhood are going to bring. There's been a lot of pushback. The R word's been thrown around, racism and
yes,
and others. But there has been a push from the aldermen there and others who've come to the aid of Alderman Arena to say, we need to move forward even in the face of opposition.
That's right. And, you know, bottom line, there is nothing controversial about this proposed development. It's near transit. The city has a transit-oriented development ordinance that says we should build more densely near transit. That's what this does. The city also, as we just talked about, has said we need affordability throughout the entire city. That's what this project does. So it's actually meeting two goals the city has set for itself. I think one thing that's important, you know, I was at one of the zoning commission hearings on this, and many of the opponents said over and over, like, I'm not racist, I'm just anti-density. And I think it's really, really important for a city like Chicago to do some education on the issue of density. And I say that because we have a really unfortunate history with density, right? And affordable housing. We have done this very poorly. Over time, we have over-densified in an attempt to concentrate people of color in one space. So it came from a racist action.
Yeah, look down the highway.
That's
Dan
right.
Ryan, right.
And so people associate that with a very negative, basically a social experiment that failed. And I think one of the things we need to do as a city is to help people understand that, one, that was an extreme version. That we don't intend to repeat. And two, it also was a place that, you know, federal funds were cut. They stopped being maintained. They changed the income rules. I mean, a lot of things happened, conspired to make that absolutely not something we want to repeat. However, seven stories near transit in Jefferson Park is nowhere near the same thing.
The last one on there, which is an interesting one because it deals with schools, and schools are obviously a big part of when you talk about desegregating Chicago schools. The city of Chicago has done selective enrollment and other things to make sure that we're not just having a center of neighborhood schools where one school doesn't have anything and then a more affluent neighborhood gets everything. There's been different experiments throughout the last couple decades in changing the way we do schools. But this recent news of a recent merge between Ogden and Jenner was one that you see as moving in the right direction.
I do. And again, it's two
schools.
Another
controversial thing, but go ahead.
It did, and it took quite a while, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And you know, to put in context, it is two schools, right, out of a district with over 600 schools. But I think symbols matter. I think steps matter. I think the symbol that this the signal that this sends really matters, in the sense we had one school in Ogden that is, you know, much higher income and pretty crowded. And nearby, you had Jenner School, which traditionally served young people from Cabrini Green. And with those, you know, much of that being torn down, the school was quite underutilized. And so the idea was to bring the two schools together, and the principals were around this, and many parents were around it. But many quite clearly were not for this merger. And so I think there a very important conversation played out. And I was at one of the hearings about this and testified. And I think there is a really important thing to understand here about kind of how we think about our spaces. Mm-hmm. There were parents who were against the merger, who certainly saw this as kind of a question of, what do I get for my property taxes? And I pay very high property taxes, so I merit a school like Ogden.
Right.
And, you know, that's a pretty hard thing to wrap your head around when you're all part of one school district.
Well, there's so many issues to unpack. I mean, especially when you talk about pushback, residential pushback, and what stands in the way of desegregating a major city, one that historically has been segregated. And we'll continue that conversation. Marisa Navarro is the director with the Metropolitan Planning Council. They've undertaken a lot of this research and work to not only find out what the cost of segregation is, but what we can do to desegregate. Marisa, thanks so much for being my guest tonight. And you got to come back, and we'll continue the conversation.
Thanks. Great talking with you.
All right, Cory Doctorow coming up here at the big table. Looking forward to talking to the novelist, activist, journalist. Boing Boing's one of my favorite sites. It really is. He's a co-editor on the site. It has been for years. I feel like that's like the what would you call it, the gold standard for blogs that aggregate, for blogs that talk about things that are happening on the internet, issues in the internet. It's a great site. So Cory Doctorow coming up, the big table. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9 o'clock hour, we'll talk about whether or not Chicago is heading towards a newspaper monopoly. Of course, we saw a lot this week about bids for the Chicago Sun-Times. Their rival, Trunk, the Chicago Tribune, has put a bid in, but also a former alderman in Chicago has. We'll talk about what some of the staffers at the Sun-Times think, or the Reader, more specifically. They'll be in studio. Also tonight, one of I wouldn't even say Chicago, I'd say the country's rising chefs. Noah Sandoval is the head chef at Oriole. When he just got on the Food and Wine list for best chefs, the only Chicago representation this year. If you're at all a foodie in Chicago, you know of Oriole and you know of his work. We'll talk to him about how he got to Chicago and how he got started washing dishes. So we'll talk to Noah Sandoval. And, of course, as we've been talking about all show long, Ted McClellan will be here, How to Speak Midwestern. We will get you to call up, and Ted's going to see if he can pick out where you're from. Pretty simple radio concept. Let's see if it works. 312-981-7200. We'll do it for prizes, too. Well, my next guest is going to be at LitFest this weekend at Printer's Row. Cory Doctorow is a New York Times bestselling author, and he's got a new novel called Walk Away. The novel falls under the category of dystopian science fiction, although I might put it in a new category, utopian nonfiction, because it reads like it's something that could happen tomorrow, because the book takes place in a world where our economy collapses, the middle class disappears for good, and the rich, well, it's all that's left, except for the walkaways, who are they use technology to manufacture food, drugs, entertainment, and even stumble on a way to beat death. It's a startling story because, like I said, it feels like it could happen tomorrow. But what's more is that Cory takes a fresh look at an old genre and questions whether or not societal collapse would reign chaos, or maybe something different, maybe something more positive. And it also asks the question, who owns technology? And at the end of the day, will it be the ultimate equalizer? Cory Doctorow is one of my favorite journalists and editors. He's the co-editor of the amazing site Boing Boing, which writes about and collects unique stories from all corners of the internet. And Doctorow is also an activist who continually pushes for a truly free and open internet. And it's my pleasure to welcome Cory Doctorow to the Download tonight at the big table. Cory, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here.
It's, you know, it's a great book. And it's, like I said, I mean, the idea that it feels like it's something that's real. It feels, even with all the sort of science fiction and the things that play out, the idea that we can use 3D printers to make food or drugs or beer or whatever it might be, there's something in this book that even though it's science fiction, it feels real.
Well, you know, I think that like when we write science fiction, we're writing pulp literature, which is great. I love reading pulp and I love writing pulp. And pulp is literature where the plot is front and center. And so it's always tempting to ask your audience to go along with you when you like sideline what is known to be real in the world and in order to further the plot. So like right. with, you know, stories about computers and the internet, you know, techno thrillers, we often ask computers to do impossible things or pretend that they can't do things that they do all day long with us. And the audience kind of goes along for the ride. But it turns out that when you make the computers act like computers and structure the plot around the constraints and capabilities of real computers, the story feels like yeah. really urgent. Now, you know, when we write disaster novels, we're really tempted to like mash up man against man and man against nature and make a man against nature against man story. So like the earthquake comes and knocks your building down, your neighbors come over to eat you, right?
Right.
But the reality of that is that like when disaster hits, that's the time when people are most generous, most noble, when they rise to the occasion. I was just in England touring this book when the bombs went off in Manchester. That was not a moment in which people devolved into barbarism. It was a moment in which the better
everybody
natures
came together, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And so, you know, we know that like mostly our neighbors are good and they would all be fine. You know, statistically, it would be really unlikely if 99.9% of the world were total jerks, but everyone we knew is more or less okay. Like, probably everyone you know is a representative sample of everyone, which is to say, you know, sort of flawed vessels who have good days and bad days.
Right.
But writing this, I call it an optimistic disaster novel in which in times of crisis, the problem isn't that your neighbors are your enemy. The problem is that rich dudes believe that your neighbors are your enemy and everyone else is just trying to get along. That, I think, creates a kind of immediacy and realism to the story.
Why do you think that the disaster genre or the idea of chaos and a collapse, and whether it be natural disaster or societal collapse, why do you think it always goes there? Where do you think that comes from in the human spirit that we automatically think if that happens, the world, we're all going to go around cutting each other's heads off and it's going to be back to Animal Farm?
Well, you know, writing about disasters is not intrinsically pessimistic, right? Like, if you're an engineer and you design a system on the assumption that it'll just never break down, you don't build a good system, you build the Titanic. Right. So it is like a realistic and even hopeful thing to say, OK, we can design a system that will fail someday, but will fail gracefully. Right. It'll coast to a gentle stop instead of exploding and showering everyone around with white hot shrapnel.
Right.
So, of course, disasters always come up because everything has a bounding condition. Things fall apart. Right. Now, we do like that super plotty element of man against man against nature, but there's also often a certain amount of elitism or racism or kind of a buried assumption that like the good people are the people who are like you and the underclasses are just being barely held in check. After all, there's a kind of ideology that goes along with the idea that some people will have so much more than everyone else. It's that they deserve it. And if the people who have so much more than everyone else deserves it,
yeah,
then everyone else must deserve less. And I think
you almost pen in the underclass in the disaster genre. Like when it's all done and said and done and it happens, you see more and more. And I'm only thinking of movies, but where everybody's trying to get on the boat. You know,
yeah.
This idea that they're over here, but it's up to us to figure out who can move on.
It's not just in literature; it's in reality, right? When the Titanic sank, half the seats on the lifeboats were empty because people were afraid that if they let the people in the sea into the boat, that they would overwhelm the boat. After Katrina, we famously imprisoned people who'd committed no crime in the dome and then fabricated instances of rape that were never validated and violence, where really it was just, you know, poor people who hadn't been evacuated from New Orleans who were penned up. My favorite example of this, and these all come from this book by Rebecca Solnit called A Paradise Built in Hell, which is a wonderful history book of how good people are in disasters and how rich people never believe it, is that after the 1906 quake in San Francisco, General Funston marched his troops out of the barracks in the Presidio convinced of two things that he was totally catastrophically wrong about. The first was that he knew how to set fire breaks with controlled demolitions, which he didn't.
Okay. Not something good to be wrong about.
Yeah. And then the second was that if he let people back in to fight the fires that he just set, that they would loot their neighborhoods. And so he burned down a quarter of San Francisco because he wouldn't let poor people back in to fight the fires that he'd set. There were no verified instances of looting except for two soldiers who went into a cigar store that the fire was about to consume and took a box of cigars.
Corey, what I love about the book, and it's hard to separate your life being an activist and an advocate and what you write about, not just with Boing Boing, but what you do just around the world when you speak in front of conferences about a free and open internet or copyright laws or digital rights. You feel like all of that is almost research for this novel in the way that your life and how you live it as a journalist and a speaker, it informs the plots, the characters, everything in it. I mean, there's a whole, right at the beginning, there's a whole part about copyright, and it's about around mattresses and this idea that things that I never really thought about. And I don't know if I would think about in a science fiction novel.
Well, yeah, you know, I do like have this approach to my work, which is that I take everything that comes over my transom and I write it up for Boing Boing for public consumption. And rather than write a note in a little notebook, and there's a thing about writing things up for the public, which is that you have to approach it with a little more rigor. You can't cheat and say, oh, I'll know what I meant later. I'll just make some cursory notes and come back to it. And that's very mnemonic. You end up with your subconscious becoming a kind of super saturated solution of fragments of stories that, you know, eventually like to the chunks nucleate and then crystallize into something bigger. But, you know, I also think that like, the book is in some ways a formal exercise about projecting some of the things that have been amazing about the internet and technology into other spheres. So, you know, Ronald Coase won the Nobel Prize in 1937 for the theory of the firm, this paper, economics paper, that said the reason we organize institutions is to coordinate our work so we can do more than one person could do, to be superhuman. So it's the church or a criminal institution or a corporation or a government. They all exist to coordinate labor. And the thing that the internet has done is it's like monotonically reduced how much coordination you need to do more and more ambitious things. So now we can like build encyclopedias or operating systems with the kind of institutional capacity we used to bring to a really ambitious bake sale, right? So Walkaway in part is like, how would we run a space program that way? How would we build a skyscraper that
way?
Start
a new society, right?
Imagine if you could build a skyscraper the way that we build operating systems today. So you'd say, like, I got this patch of dirt. Who's got some, you know, structural steel or architectural drawings or office furniture lying around? We'll just come and we'll, like, tinker for a while. We'll add stuff. We'll take it away. And when we're done, we'll not only have an office building, we'll have the greatest office building ever built. We can infinitely replicate it and everyone can use it for free, right?
Great.
So that's kind of the challenge in Walkaway.
Creative Commons architecture. Right?
Yeah.
Corey Doctorow is my guest. He's the author of Walkaway, also a co-editor at Boing Boing. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and continue our conversation here at the Big Table. Stay with us. One of those favorite authors in studio tonight, Corey Doctorow, will be at the Lit Fest this weekend. When are you on? Saturday?
Sunday.
Sunday
at 11:30.
Sunday at 11:30, his new novel is Walk Away. Corey Doctorow has been an activist for a free and open internet, copyright laws, digital rights. There's so much that you've done, not only with Boing Boing being a co-editor, but in your time as just someone who's a constant keynote speaker at a lot of these hacker conferences. And I want to talk more about that because, you know, I try and I keep up on these things. And I really, really find myself curious and interested in some of the movements that are happening when it comes to a free and open internet. And a lot of times I head scratch, like probably a lot of my listeners right now going, what is the fight over copyright on the internet? When we talk about digital management, what is that? You know,
sure.
Those kind of things. So why don't we start with, you know, because there are some themes in the book around copyright, the idea of who owns technology copyrights, things of that nature that you feel real strongly about when it comes to Creative Commons and keeping it free and open.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, copyright has historically been like a regulatory regime for the entertainment industry, right? It's about like how people like me who create things relate to my publisher, to retailers, to film companies that might want to adapt our work. And it's a complicated technical body of laws, you'd expect, because it's kind of a complicated technical industry. And every regulation always has something to say who is covered by this regulation. It's way more important than whether the regulation is a good one or a bad one. It's who it applies to. And the thing that copyright used as a test to see are you in or out of the entertainment industry was, are you making or handling copies of creative works? Of works, right? And that historically was a pretty good test because if you had a record, there was a record pressing plant in its history, right? If you had a book, there was a printing press involved. But the internet works by making copies. And so everything we do on the internet involves making copies. Now, the idea that entertainment law should be how we regulate the single wire that delivers free speech, a free press, freedom of assembly, access to education, tools, civic participation, political life, education, better employment, access to our families, to our friends, all of those things, that's crazy. And, you know, there isn't a copyright rule that is on the one hand streamlined and simple enough that a kid in her mom's basement in Napierville who's writing some Harry Potter fanfic can come on the right side of it. And complicated and nuanced enough that Universal and Warner can use it to broker right. their licensing deal to build a Harry Potter theme park.
I mean, is there any movement in our society to deal with that from governments, whether it be the United States or others, that say, we got to change this. We have to come up with a new law for the internet.
So unfortunately, it's just the worst, right? We keep expanding the powers of copyright holders to enforce copyright not against people who are like in the industry, but against audiences. You know, if you have to understand copyright in order to read a book, copyright has failed, right?
Right.
The only thing you should have to understand in order to read a book is how to read. And so we now have things like this rule, the Digital Rights Management Rule from 1998, the DMCA. This is this law that was passed in the Clinton years. And it has this clause that says if you have a thing that protects copyright, a lock, a digital lock that protects copyright, removing that lock is a felony, punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine for a first offense, even if you do so for a lawful purpose. So at first that was like, okay, you can't change your DVD player to play DVDs you bought in India. Now let's make sure that we note here, buying a DVD in India is not piracy. It's just buying it from a place where it's cheaper. And like, yeah, of course, every business would like you to buy their product in the most expensive way.
Right,
but like,
right.
still not piracy. But now, because there's copyrighted works in everything, in toasters and cars and heart monitors and voting machines, companies have figured out that if you just add a digital lock, so that using the product in a way that doesn't maximize their profits requires removing or tampering with the lock, then it becomes a felony not to order your affairs in a way that is maximally beneficial to the shareholders of the company.
That's crazy. And it's crazy because you think about, like you said, I mean, the strength of the internet is people being able to take one source and another source, mash it up, do different things, create, like you were almost talking about in the first segment about building a skyscraper. The idea that we as a society can move in a new direction by using the tools that are available to us to make something different.
Well, and it goes well beyond that, right? Because historically, like if you wanted to fix a car, all you needed to know is how to fix the car. But today, in order to fix the car, you need to read the telemetry out of the engine. Not hard to build a computer to do that. But in order to do that, you have to bypass a copyright lock. So GM right now charges $75,000 for the authorized tool to do that. Or if you're a mechanic, you can commit a felony by buying a third-party tool that costs like $100. And GM sells that tool to the mechanics who only buy first-party parts. And then they add more locks to the parts so that the car can handshake with the part to make sure you're not using a third-party part and using GM's high markup parts. John Deere's using this in tractors to stop farmers from fixing their own tractors and to stop farmers from unlocking the data that they generate when they drive their tractors around their fields, data about what the soil conditions are in their fields because the torque sensors on the wheels and the humidity sensors, centimeter by centimeter, they tell them where to put the seed. But to get that seed out of your tractor, the data you generated driving your tractor around your field that you paid for, you have to pay Deere for it and to buy it as an app that comes with seed from Monsanto. Right. So this is the real problem is we have taken this weird entertainment law that's a relic of the last century. And rather than saying, well, in the era of the internet, maybe we need to rethink it. We've said, no, in the era of the internet, we need to make this apply to everything. Like there is no reason you couldn't use this law to build a toaster with a vision system that rejected third party bread. Right. And then figuring out how to put your own bread in your own damn toaster would be a felony. So I want to mention...
Or if you don't use the right bread or the bread that has been...
The authorized bread.
The authorized
bread. It's the inkjet business. It's the inkjet printer business model for insulin pumps. So I work part-time for a nonprofit called Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. And in summer 2015, we brought a lawsuit against the U.S. government on behalf of a Johns Hopkins researcher and an MIT adjunct Bunny Wang and Matthew Green to invalidate this law on the grounds that it's unconstitutional, and that's now working its way through the courts. But, you know, this is a major opportunity because right now we have American small and medium enterprises that rely on breaking these locks in order to do things like fix your phone, right? Fixing a ton of electronics creates 250 jobs. Recycling a ton of electronics creates 15 jobs.
It seems to run in the face of American entrepreneurship. Just the concept of, you know, everything that we've heard in the last 6 months, even with a new president and a president administration, that you know, we need to get rid of these regulations. We got to get rid of these laws that are stopping businesses from moving forward. Do you see any correlation when I think of the Trump administration and the stuff you're talking about? There's a lock, or is it just lobbied to death and there's no way that they're going to see that in the same way that you're talking about?
Yeah, it is lobbied to death. And I think that the advantage that we have, if we're going to win this fight, it's that the number of people who realize that the internet is more than like a superior video on demand service or the world's greatest pornography distribution service or, you know, recruiting tool for jihadis, that pool of people is only ever going to grow, right? The number of people who rely on fair and open technology is never going to decline from here on in. I call it peak indifference. And, you know, as a Chicago native son showed us, as Aaron Swartz showed us when he helped organize the fight against SOPA, putting 8 million phone calls through the Congress in 3 days can change a whole lot of minds.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. And then I do want to talk about Aaron because we've talked about him on this program before. We'll talk about his story. Well, also, there's so much more I want to talk about. Cory Doctorow in studio tonight. He is at LitFest this weekend, Sunday, 11:30. His novel is called Walk Away. It's out now. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio, my guest at the big table, Cory Doctorow, activist, journalist, author, best-selling author, New York Times best-selling author. His new novel, Walk Away, is out right now. He's going to be at the Lit Fest, Printers Row Lit Fest this weekend, Sunday, 11:30. You know, we're talking about not just a novel, but a lot of issues on the internet as we sort of kind of unpack a little bit of the storylines and the issues and things that we don't really talk about in the media. And I don't know why it is. I mean, if you go to Boing Boing and you really, if you're committed to understand, you can find out all that stuff. But I'm always surprised there's not an internet section in the newspapers or more mainstream television coverage of the issues that are happening around the digital world. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that mainstream media kind of shies away from talking about some of these things?
Well, you know, I think we like to package up our stories about technical subjects as kind of discrete discoveries that are made by people as opposed to continuous processes that are kind of messy and don't have any neat beginning and ending.
Yeah.
So, you know,
to tell the story, right?
Yeah. So Bruce Schneier is one of the world's great security experts. He always says security is a process and not a product. You know, the way that we make something secure is not by building the best thing we can and then declaring it to be secure. The way that we make it secure is by telling people how it works and then waiting to see what dumb mistakes we've made that they can point out to us, right?
All right.
But that's not unique to security. I mean, that's knowledge creation in general from the earliest days of the Enlightenment, right? Like before the Enlightenment, what we had instead of science was alchemy. And so alchemists worked like scientists, but they didn't tell anyone what they thought they'd found out, because they didn't want anyone else to beat them to turn lead into gold. That's how alchemists discovered for the hard way, each of them for themselves, not to drink mercury, right? And you know, it's the same with many technical subjects, that whenever we get into technical subjects, people want it to be like a guy invented a thing and now it is here, as opposed to these people created an encryption algorithm and then they wrote some papers about it and then other mathematicians poked at it and then someone implemented it in software and then we went to see whether it would work. And, you know, encryption is indeed amazing, right? Like, it is a new thing in this world. You can take that distraction rectangle out of your pocket, pause briefly from throwing pigs at birds with it, and you can, like, take a message and scramble it so thoroughly that if all the hydrogen in the atoms in the universe were computers, they did nothing until the end of the universe but guess at keys. We would run out of universe long before we ran out of keys. But then you get our security services saying, well, okay, that's great, but can't you make one of those that works perfectly except when we need to like read a terrorist email and then it needs to fail catastrophically? And we don't know how to do that, right? And all we can do is make a system that has a known flaw and cross our fingers. Well, that is not a plan. That's a wish,
right?
And when you consider that that encryption is what protects like your heart monitor from getting malicious wireless software updates and your car from getting malicious wireless software updates and your baby monitor from leaking footage of you and your most intimate moments with your family all over the internet, we can't afford to weaken that. Not because terrorism isn't a problem, but because you don't solve the problem by allowing terrorists and criminals and bad governments and bad cops and good cops with bad ideas from breaking all of this stuff. And this is where hacking comes in, right?
Yeah, because I want to ask you about that. That's, you know, we talk about hacking and,
right.
And hacking is a word that means a lot of things to a lot of different people. I mean, you hear hacking in on CNN and it has everything to do with somebody, you know, that they give you the idea of someone in a basement who hacked into something they shouldn't have. And then there's other hacking where you're like, no, people are getting past that the algorithms and some of the things that you're talking about, even the digital locks, and getting to a space that creates something new.
Yeah, they're trying to figure out what the limits of the system are and trying to explore it and figure out what flaws exist in it. And that's important because, like, without an experimental methodology for validating security, except for trial and error, right, except for letting people go after it, then if you ban people from exploring the security of systems and telling us when the systems that we rely on literally to keep us alive have flaws in them, then what happens is we don't discover those flaws until the bad guys have independently rediscovered them and exploited them so widely that we can no longer deny their existence.
It's the concept that we see with when credit cards get hacked. The same concept or a credit card system at a retail store.
Sure.
And then they tell us after the fact and you find out that was a year ago.
Oh, well, it gets worse than that, right? You know, we know from the CIA leaks that they had been warehousing flaws that they had found in operating systems like Windows. So they would discover these operating system flaws. And rather than going to Microsoft and saying everyone who uses Windows is at risk because we found this bug, they would keep it a secret. They would write exploits, they would write weapons that use that bug to attack their adversaries, and they cross their fingers and hope that nobody would independently rediscover it and use it to attack Americans. Well, when that cache of cyber weapons leaked, we found that the average rate of rediscovery was about 20% per year. Any bug that they discover would be rediscovered in the wild. And then those bugs that they'd sat on were weaponized into the WannaCry worm that went around and shut down 35 hospitals in the UK, entire banking systems, FedEx. I mean, you know, we can't afford to not have hackers hacking on our systems and telling us about the flaws, because otherwise the only hackers who will hack on our systems are the ones who don't tell us about the flaws.
That's right. Well, I mean, the other way we've heard hack, and we've heard this in the political realm ad nauseum for the last 6 months, is the quote unquote Russian hack or attempt to hack our elections or to hack emails. You know, all different words the word hack has been used. You know, at just having this conversation, you automatically, when you read in the New York Times, Washington Post, or even from our political, even today, watching the Comey hearings, there seems to be this way in which everybody just sort of assumes they know what it is. And I don't know if everybody understands what it means that the Russians, quote unquote, hacked or tried to hack our elections. I mean, do you see that it almost seems simplistic in a way? And by doing that, it seems ignorant.
Well, you know, one of the truisms in security is, quote, attribution is hard. It's really hard to figure out who's attacking who. Like those NSA cyber weapons that just leaked, as opposed to the CIA ones, those ones were hosted on servers in Russia and China. Because the NSA was taking over servers in other countries to launch their attacks from, because they didn't want the attacks to look like they were coming from America, right? I mean, that's like a normal thing that intelligence agencies and other entities do. I once had Boing Boing hacked and defaced, and the people who hacked us from another hacked computer so that we couldn't backtrack who they were. That's very, very, very common. And so, and actually, we've just had all these amazing stories about one of the Russian, potentially state-involved hacking groups. We don't know if they're state-involved or whether they're just independents and maybe they sell stuff to the state. Who knows? But they had malicious software that would take over computers. And then rather than phoning their server to say, I'm in, I'm here, which might tip off someone who was watching, who saw the attack and was watching to see where it phoned home so they could go and bust those guys or shut down their command server. It would leave a comment on Britney Spears' Instagram account with an encrypted web address that the command and control server would look at and figure out how to contact its slaves out there in the, on the internet, its bots out
That's
there on the
internet.
It's
amazing to think about.
And, I mean, yeah,
it's funny. I mean, it's funny because it's Britney Spears'
right.
Instagram account, but it's also amazing to think that this is sophisticated stuff, even down to the point of burying commands on random celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, hashtag leave Britney alone and all. But, you know, with Russia, like, so during the Arab Spring, I knew people who knew people who were hacking the Tunisian government and the Egyptian government in solidarity with the uprisings there. And some of those people had worked for the U.S. military or U.S. intelligence. Some of those people had worked for private security research outfits, some of whom contracted to U.S. intelligence. And I'm sure that U.S. intelligence knew that at least some of that stuff was going on and decided not to do anything about it. That is not the same thing as saying Barack Obama ordered American hackers to take down the Tunisian government, but it's also not the same thing as saying Barack Obama had nothing to do right. with hackers who took down the Tunisian government.
So it could be very similar in when we talk about the Russian hack.
Sure.
It is state-driven, meaning it's on behalf of the state, but it may not be that that Vladimir Putin is
directed
going,
by the state, but the state benefits and the state turns a blind eye to it. I don't know. I mean, maybe the state is ordering it because that's another thing that happens is sometimes governments order their military intelligence hackers to take out other countries or to attack other countries. But it would be foolish to assume that people in Russia don't feel strongly that Russia has been done badly, that Hillary Clinton was an enemy of theirs. I mean, the oligarchs in particular have a lot of money to spend convincing people that the Secretary of State who imposed sanctions on them that hurt their bottom line was an enemy of Russia and someone who was working against the interests of them and their beloved old grandparents and their kids and the future that they wanted to build for them. I mean, whether you agree with them, and, you know, I'm someone of Russian ancestry and I don't agree with them. My grandmother was a child soldier in the siege of Leningrad. I'm no fan of Vladimir Putin, and I think those people are wrong if they think that Putin is someone who has their best interests and their future at heart. But there are a lot of Russians who believe that.
Cory Doctorow is my guest tonight. He's the author of Walk Away, the novel. He's at LitFest on Sundays. Also the co-editor at Boing Boing and an activist and an advocate for free and open internet, copyright, digital rights management, that kind of thing. You know, before I let you go, we've talked about Aaron Swartz on the show. Aaron was a story that a lot of people didn't pay attention to. A whiz kid, really, I remember we interviewed him when he was 13 years old. And we had the guy who came in and wrote his bio. We talked about the story on the show. He was here at the big table about a kid who went in and hacked education manuals, essentially, right? The idea of like, what do you call those?
He downloaded scientific papers.
That's what
he wrote a little script. So he had he was a fellow at Harvard. He had a reciprocal arrangement with MIT that let him go down there and use their network. MIT had a thing, access to scholarly libraries of scientific papers you were allowed to download. But the terms of service that you had to click through that no one has ever read ever on anything said you will only download them by clicking on links, not by writing a script. And in 1986, Congress passed this law called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that says that using a computer in a way that exceeds your authorization is a felony.
And they ended up catching him doing it, downloading it, and they wanted to throw the book at him.
They charged him with 13 felonies. He was facing 35 years in prison when he hanged himself in 2013.
You were friends with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you think about the work that he did and the idea that the U.S. government at the time was so unfriendly to because it wasn't malicious in the way that he wasn't using this for anything, that even some of the things that we're talking about tonight. I mean, he was essentially, maybe we don't even know what he was going to do with that. Yeah. He could be using it for just research.
He checked too many books out of the library.
When you hear that story and you talk about that story and your friendship with him, you know, what comes to mind? What comes to mind to be in this world, to be fighting for a free and open internet?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that if anyone out there is contemplating suicide, as Aaron did, that the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is what you should be thinking about first and foremost. That whatever Aaron did and whatever his legacy is, that speaking as someone who is a colleague and comrades of Aaron's, he would be much better as a living activist than he is as a dead example. His martyrdom, it was a very dear price to pay, and not a good bargain that we struck in this world. I think about it, and I think about this bad law, this Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, that was passed after the movie War Games came out. Congress saw War Games, saw a young Matthew Broderick potentially launching World War III from his basement, and decided something must be done. And so they passed this ridiculous law that said using a computer in a way that exceeds your authorization is a felony. And, you know, we have like echoes of that today, where we have these weird ideas about how encryption works, about how computer security works. And in part, it's driven by people like me, science fiction writers, who've used lazy storytelling to make up stories about computers that act in impossible ways. And technological realism is so salient and so important in so many ways, because right now we have lawmakers whose answer to "we don't know how to make the system you want to build, and the system you want to build will make us all less secure" is nerds nerd harder, right? You need to just figure this out, because I've seen it, right? We can make encryption that doesn't work when the bad guys are using it. It works fine when the good guys are using it. Just go figure that stuff out. Don't bother me with details, Poindexter. The reality is that, like, all the stuff that happened to Aaron will be 10 million times worse if we can't build good working cryptography into our systems. It will allow not just sophisticated state actors like the potential Russian state elements who directed these attacks to come after us in comprehensive ways. It'll allow dum-dums to come after us. You know, those malware attacks, the WannaCry attacks, the ransom they were asking for was $300. Right? Because those guys were dumb, petty crooks who happened on this fantastically powerful cyber weapon that the CIA had left lying around where anyone could find it and weaponize it and exploit it. We need robust cybersecurity that is grounded in evidence, not in lazy storytelling by bad science fiction writers or even good science fiction writers. And so, you know, one of the reasons that I devote myself in my fiction to technological realism is because I want people to walk away from this understanding not just that computers are like interesting and cool and important right now, but having a sense of what their actual contours are. And, you know, that's been the thing I've deployed in my books like Little Brother. It's what I use in Walk Away. I wrote a piece for the MIT Tech Review on how Mr. Robot does this and how we're entering a kind of golden age now of technological realism, where the audience has finally caught up with people who write about and talk about the actual way computers work, and where they care in the same way that they might care about a Western where the horses magically can fly, right? Like, let's make the computers act like computers.
Yeah, that's great. Cory Doctorow, activist, advocate, journalist, as well as an author. His new book, Walk Away, a novel, is out now. He will be at LitFest in Printer's Row on Sunday at 11:30. Cory, awesome to have you here. Thanks for being my guest at the Big
Thank
Table.
Thank you.
That was fun. That's great, man. LitFest is a really great opportunity to get not just authors, but people who are leaders in their field. You know what I mean? Like, I'm glad that he wrote the book, and the book is good. It's good, and it's awesome that he has two lives where he can be an internet activist and talk about the issues that we never think about. You know, maybe I'll just speak for myself, because I'm sure there are many people in Download Nation right now that are like, I think about it every day. But, you know, for me, I will get into, and we didn't get into issues like net neutrality or politics. You know, one thing I wanted to talk about, maybe next time Corey comes in, is that when will issues on the internet, privacy, net neutrality, who pays for what, copyright, digital locks, when will they become political platforms? You see it in Europe there a little bit, where people are running on those concepts in London I think it was, he was in the break, we were talking about Iceland. But you don't see it here. You know, I mean, we saw a really, really, really obnoxious debate where the president, who's now the president, Donald Trump, was saying, computers and my 13-year-old kid. And like, he just kind of belittled the issues that are happening in a platform that we all use. And you start to recognize that if this platform at some point or another gets even bigger than it is now, and it becomes, and it is already, the idea that our refrigerators run off of the internet.
Yeah.
and nobody has checked the box or understood the things that big business does to essentially make money or put us in a situation where we're paying more for less, I think that has to be addressed at some point. And I just wonder if we'll listen more to people like Corey and other activists who are really, in a way that young politicians do, I mean, really whipping up loyalty in a younger audience. I mean, you get kids in their 20s right now, they'll tell you that they're paying much, much more attention to issues of copyright and digital. I mean, this all stems, it's so great because it all stems out of the late 90s with Napster. It's like the beginning of what is the internet and what can it do for us and what costs money and what doesn't.
I'm very naive towards it too. Like especially with security, I just assume that everything's being taken care of. You know, half my passwords are still, you know, password 1234.
Right.
I don't, you know, and then when I hear him talk, it's like, oh my God, this is going on. Like, I'm getting right on there, like, gonna change everything up.
My 1234 has got to go.
That's frightening.
All right, we'll shift gears. We'll talk about the local news landscape and Chef Noah Sandoval in studio tonight from the famed restaurant Oriole. We'll talk to him about his inclusion in the Food and Wine magazine top new chefs list that's out now. So we'll talk with him about that here in The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later in the show, Noah Sandoval is going to be here from Oriole. Talk about his career, one of the rising chefs in the Chicago culinary world. We'll talk with him. He was just on the Food and Wine Best Upcoming or Rising Chefs, right? He's got to go out to Aspen in a couple weeks to cook for all the skiers in the summer. He's in the wrong... season, but we'll find out how that goes. And then also coming up at 10 o'clock, Ted McClellan's going to be back. We're going to be talking about accents, how to speak Midwestern, right? 312-981-7200. Ted's going to guess your accent. So we want people from Iowa, Minnesota, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Chicago to call in. We'll also talk about some of the glossary items you can text. We got a whole thing. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. So let's have some fun tonight. 312-981-7200. Well, you may have been paying attention to the news that the news is for sale. Well, a newspaper. Rapports, the parent company of the Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Reader, is for sale. The Justice Department put a deadline on bids, and two emerged, one from rival Chicago company Tronc, whose CEO Michael Farrow used to be a primary shareholder over at Rapports, and another from a group led by former Chicago alderman Edward Eisendrath. But staffers at the Sun-Times Reader have been critical of the sale and the timing, mostly because they believe it was a done deal, and they've petitioned the Justice Department to extend the bidding some more so that others can kick the tires and they can avoid what they see as a Chicago news monopoly. In studio with me, two staff members from the Chicago Readers and members of the Chicago News Guild, Amy Levitt and Maya Dukmasova. Did I get that right? Did I get close enough?
Close.
I tried. It was in my head that whole time I was reading it. Maya, Amy, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so let's get into this. You know, a Chicago news monopoly, the idea of one company owning both newspapers. This is something that concerns you guys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's an issue that maybe isn't on a lot of people's radars, especially now with how much news content is consumed online. But the Sun-Times and the Tribune have been two very distinctive voices in the city for a very long time, and they serve and really focus their coverage on different issues. They serve different populations. We think that it's important to maintain them as separate independent entities, as well as the Reader.
Amy, I mean, one of the things that came out of the idea that if there was one company was a list of all the properties. And this is really what grabbed my attention was we've been talking about the Sun-Times and the Tribune, and the Reader gets thrown in as well. But if Tronc does get the Rapports, you're talking about pretty much a huge percentage of the media publications in this town.
Yeah, I mean, they'll have both the dailies. They'll have Chicago Magazine. They'll have the Red Eye, which is news and entertainment. They'll have the Reader, which also does news and entertainment, but also other things. They'll have Oi, which does that all in Spanish. I mean,
And a plethora of suburban papers, too.
Yeah, but they don't cover the same stuff we do. But yeah, I mean, they'll have so much.
So you're concerned about it. I mean, what? I mean,
why would they want us if they have Chicago Magazine and the Red Eye?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, but the idea there, it's not a new idea. There are some cities. I think it's Philadelphia that mm-hmm. has one owner that owns the papers there. I mean, and they seem to be coexisting and figuring it out. Maybe there's not a problem with one owner owning all of those entities.
Well, the concern that we have is that inevitably, if there's one owner for all of these different businesses, there's going to be business-oriented decisions that have to be made about merging the staffs, merging, the business end of things, consolidating things, you know, eliminating redundancies. And while there's been this pledge that Tronc would maintain a separate newsroom, the Sun-Times would be a separate newsroom, there's really not much conversation happening about the Reader, so we're really in the dark about what the plans are for us.
We're like the extra when they throw in at the end of the infomercial.
Right.
Buy now, you get the Reader.
Yeah. So they've pledged to maintain the Sun-Times as a separate newsroom, but they really only would have to do it for, I think, a year and a half or 2 years or something like that. And you got to wonder, you know, if you're trying to run a business, like, why have two separate newsrooms? I could see down the line someone pitching it as like, oh, we're gonna bring these papers together and we're gonna have a bigger staff and we're gonna cover more things. But inevitably, there will be layoffs.
That's what happened to us when we moved in with the Sun-Times.
Yeah, how has it been? I mean, for you guys, let me ask about that. I mean, because there's been in the paper talking about the lack of a contract, you guys unionized and you haven't been able to get anywhere with these Chicago Sun-Times reports and everything in there. How has it been? Because there was a lot of concern from Chicago readers that the Chicago Reader would have consolidation issues with the Sun-Times.
Well, they've been using our content in the agenda section, which we're not even sure how the sharing goes. It's never been explained to us.
Yeah,
but
the revenue sharing.
Yeah. But they've been using, I mean, all our content goes into the agenda. We're usually, one of our stories is usually on the cover there. So, especially after they canceled all their entertainment news, pretty much. And then our sales manager left 2 years ago. He wasn't replaced. Instead, our sales people went under the, I guess, aegis of the Sun-Times sales people. So.
Yeah, so on the back end, in a way, it sort of functions as one organization more and more. Mm-hmm. And that definitely has an effect on our paper as a product.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, obviously, and you're going to have your loyal following, me included. I mean, the Chicago Reader is a place that so many Chicagoans have considered to be daily or weekly diet. But I mean, is it a bad thing that the Reader is able to come in and get some space in the Sun-Times, is able to use? I mean, I can make an argument. I'll play businessman. I'll play devil's businessman.
Go right ahead.
But the concept of being, you know, you get more firepower with a sales team from a bigger paper, from the Sun-Times coming in to help sell some of the spots in the Reader. So, I mean, at a certain point, I mean, doesn't it behoove you or give you more strength to have the resources that are available at the Sun-Times?
We don't really, though. We have like two salespeople.
Yeah, I don't think we've benefited from more firepower. I mean, I've only been at the Reader for a little less than a year, so I'm less familiar with how things were before. But I think the more apt metaphor here is that, you know, it's like the strongest member of the herd survives, preying on the energy of the weaker members of the smaller game, sort of.
It's like a revolving door with our salespeople. They keep leaving.
Yeah. And there's also, you know, there is, I think, in the city of Chicago and Chicagoans who ultimately these papers belong to them. Like, this is their resource. This is their newspapers. And, you know, throughout their history, there have been things that have only been covered by one of the outlets. And I mean, in the Sun-Times, you know, they always bring up the example of like the David Koshman case and how like it was really the Sun-Times that focused their coverage on that story and that, you know, created a situation where there was some accountability over the murder of that boy. And like the Tribune wasn't covering that. Same thing with, you know, the John Burge police torture story. Like, this was broken by John Conroy at the Reader. and he pursued it on his own for many years. Like the neither of the major papers were covering this. So, you know, it's whatever you might say for how this affects the business, there is also a question of needing different editorial voices.
Yeah. You know, I'll play devil's advocate once again. I hate to do it. A lot of media entities in this day and age, the editorial staffs don't really get a say in it. I'll be honest. I mean, we were just a big part of a sale here, and
ask your permission.
They didn't ask my permission, but you know, at a certain point, I mean, these are publicly traded companies that play at a level that's there's a firewall. They buy and sell the company and make money off that company, and the editorial staffs are left alone. At a certain point, is it hard to expect that they're not going to listen to what you guys have to say at the editorial staff, Chicago Reader?
Oh, they don't listen to us, but that's why we are agitating. That's why we're here.
Yeah,
we have a petition at the Action Network. It's No News Monopoly. If you want to go, please go and sign it. News Monopoly, and it's on Facebook too. We're trying to petition the Department of Justice. You know, the company's not listening to us, but they're saying, "Look at all these people who want more time, so we could get another buyer, maybe."
Yeah, and I mean, it's not a. There's no question that on the top tiers of this business at the company level, nobody's really cares about our opinion. I mean, to them, we're employees, we're an expense. Like, we're not, our voices don't really, matter. But that doesn't mean we can't speak about this. And I think that especially for us at The Reader, there's been a lot of, you know, frustrations negotiating this contract for over two and a half years. And we literally took our vote to authorize a strike at the paper the weekday before the sale was announced.
Like, that took the wind out of our sails.
Right. So we didn't go on strike. We just voted to allow one if it came to that. But you know, we feel like we have nothing to lose by sharing what we feel about the situation
I appreciate, I'm sure the audience appreciates it too, because a lot of times you don't get the inside story of what's happening in newspapers. You know, you guys in the story that really came out was, you know, there was a great piece out about how there was no movement on the contract. And then I think it was a Fuse piece where, you know,
Fusion,
and that essentially said, you know, they posted a picture where you guys put your salaries up in the window, and
yeah, that
and
was great.
Chicagoans got a chance though to recognize, and you know, how little journalists, especially at the Chicago Reader, are getting paid in the way that's not fair. And I think as we talk more about the issue of what it costs to buy a paper or to take over a paper, I mean, those are things that have to be brought up. The idea that journalists really aren't getting paid even a living wage at papers like The Reader.
Papers are cheap now. The average, I guess, this industry standard is 3 times the annual revenue. Well, if the paper's not making anything, maybe we have to pay them to take us.
I mean, there's every paper is dealing with declining revenue. That includes every paper in this city. I mean, Trunk is dealing with this with all of their papers. It's the same thing for all the Rapports properties. So it's definitely a reality, but we also, I think, part of the reason why we're speaking out and the goal of having this conversation is also to kind of probe and question the idea that, like, is the only way that we get to have these newspapers, these outlets, these media outlets, is, like, if, like, some billionaire says, okay, like, I want to buy a newspaper. Like, are there – part of this is in the hopes of generating a discussion of other ways to fund the media that we all need.
We had talked about the idea that it was, and we talked about this on our weekend review as well, the idea that it was a month, and then it got extended a week by the Department of Justice to let other bidders kind of kick the tires on Rapports. There were some bidders that came through, including a suburban businessman who dropped out, and also, like I mentioned, Edward Eisendrath and some unions that want to get involved. Do you want the deadline to even go further? You want more people to get the opportunity to kick the tires on Rapports?
Well, we heard that there was another bidder that didn't make the deadline on Monday, but we're still hoping that he will throw his hat in.
Yeah, and the suburban bidder that dropped out, you know, what we're hearing from our sources is essentially that he's put his weight potentially behind this group led by Eisendrath because The idea is that they would be stronger if they kind of pooled their resources. Okay. And there's Eisendrath is not alone in that camp. I mean, I don't know a whole lot of details about it. We kind of get like snippets of information here and there.
We learn
but
it
also,
from Feeder and Cranes.
Right. That's where we learn most everything.
Well, Amy, I mean, can you petition? Can you successfully petition the Department of Justice when the bid deadline has come and gone? Meaning, you know,
I think we have. It's very flexible. It's not a hard deadline like a journalist deadline. It's kind of like a business deadline.
Yeah, and I mean, we
it's
have
like a Springfield deadline.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right, I mean, they could go 2 years without a budget. Why can't we?
Right.
And we have heard kind of insider information that our petition so far has been a factor in why the DOJ has kind of put the brakes on the process so far. So initially, we thought we were going to have like a week. And then the deadline came, and then, you know, we heard that the petition did matter. So we're still, that's why we're still, we've got almost 1,600 signatures on the petition
and
now.
And where is the petition again?
It is at Action Network, No News Monopoly, or you could get it on our Facebook page, No News Monopoly.
Yeah, and you can also search for the hashtag No News Monopoly and for the hashtag Save the Reader, and there's links to it all over Twitter as well.
Chicago Reader staffers Amy Levitt and Maya Dukmasova. sorry. I know. Thank you guys for being here, and come back and give us an update on what's happening, especially if the bid gets extended. And
we'll tell you if there's good news.
Sounds good. Thanks for being here.
Yep.
All right, coming up, Noah Sandoval, chef at Oriole. We'll talk with him about his career. Having a lot of success. And 10 o'clock tonight, Ted McClellan, How to Speak Midwestern. We're going to play Guess the Accent. We need a name for this. What you talking about? No, that's not going to work. I feel like the fun of trying something new on the download is always the crowdsourcing of what we're going to call it. Like 312-981-7200. If we're playing Guess the Accent, should we like?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sound off. Sound.
This is where Rob comes in, usually.
We'll ask him about it.
Yeah.
Sound alike.
Yinzers? It's my favorite one. Gum bands.
We'll just call it gum bands.
We'll do the whoosh. We got to red up the room. That means cleaning up.
There we go.
In Pittsburgh.
Oh, man. Oh, we're onto it. I think Yinzers is what that's the name of the segment. We got it. It's done. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here at 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman. Well, this spring, the restaurant Oriole continued to rack up the accolades as Chef Noah Sandoval was named to the Food & Wine Best Chef list of 2017. This is a huge deal for chefs in the industry and gives Chicago its only entry to this year's list, a list that has some amazing history. Grant Achatz, Paul Kahn, Stephanie Izard have been on the list before. The 36-year-old chef has been turning heads and earning rave reviews for his work at the West Loop restaurant. He's not new to Chicago diners, as he was the chef at Senza, the Michelin-starred Lakeview restaurant, which closed a couple years back. But now Sandoval is all about Oriole. It's one of the best new restaurants, not just here in Chicago, but in the country, even though it didn't get a nomination from the James Beard. Semifinalist, not finalist. That's not good enough for us. Chef Noah Sandoval is my guest tonight on The Download. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk about this. I mean, this is amazing to get on this list. I mean, what's it mean to you to get on a list that included some of the chefs that I mentioned before?
That's crazy. I never thought that would happen, especially because I don't really put myself out there that much. But they came to me and they liked it and kind of worked out in my favor.
You've had a great, as I mentioned, Senza. I mean, you were Michelin starred, so people were familiar with your work coming into it. As a chef, when you open up your own place and you get good reviews, do you feel like, okay, it's time, especially when you've already been given a Michelin star, do you feel like I need to move to the next? I get another star, I got to get James Beard Award, I got to get on the Food and Wine list. Do you think that way?
I definitely feel like I need to do better, always. I still do and I always will. I mean, who doesn't? You know, of course, a James Beard nomination was amazing, and of course, Food and Wine is amazing, but you don't really think about that. I don't really think about that. I think about just making sure that the menu's better every day and that the people that are spending their time with me are happy and people that are eating at the restaurant are happy, you know? And I think that's the main thing for me. When those things do happen,
it's
insane.
Let's talk about your career, because, I mean, I'll have a lot of chefs on the show and they'll talk about jumping from restaurant to restaurant to restaurant, or they go to culinary school, they worked with certain people, and you've done all that. But you started your career as a dishwasher.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, I tried to figure out a way where I could make money Well, I dropped out of high school, and I decided that that would be a good idea for me to
Dropped out of high school.
Yeah, I went to school for about 2 months, and I thought I hated it. That was stupid.
Where was this at? This Virginia?
Richmond, Virginia. Yeah. So the natural thing for me to do was to start smoking weed.
Yeah, right.
You know, try to start a band, a punk band, mm-hmm. and get a job that is very flexible, and somebody would hire me just like this kid, you know, was on acid all the time. Like, what can I do? You know. So washing dishes fit the bill for that. So I got a job at a restaurant called Helen's, working with a bunch of musicians. I mean, all the cooks, all the owners even, all the servers, all the front of the house, are all in different bands and just, you know, living the life.
What did you, at that point, I mean, you were just getting a job because you needed money and you wanted to be a musician. What was it about that experience and starting to be involved with and have a life inside the kitchen that had you wanting more?
I think at first it was the lifestyle. You know, it was more about these guys can do this job and work in this kind of environment. You don't have to dress yourself up. You don't really have to do much. You just have to, you know, make sure you're nice to people. You can look however you want. And you can essentially set your own schedule, you know, especially in places like Richmond, you know, where it's not as demanding. Second to that was realizing that I like eating and I like, right. you know, and I like immediate gratification. And even if something takes 2 days to make, it's still pretty immediate gratification. So if you can make something go from 0 to 60 and taste good within 2 hours, that's for me, especially with the environment and everything like that. So,
what was the moment where you started to get serious about this? I mean, to go from an aspiring punk musician to a Michelin-starred chef, when did you start to get serious? What was the moment that you said, you know what, I could do this?
I think it was a specific dinner I had at a restaurant that I worked at. Actually, I moved up to working like the cold side, and I took a night off, and this chef, one of my good friends now, he actually was just in town for a week with me, said, hey, why don't you come into dinner? Take a night off, come into dinner, and I'll show you what we do here, you know. And I had – this experience was crazy because I cook the food and I taste the food, you know, when I'm in the back. But you sit down, it's like, wow, this really moves people. You know, it's really – it's art, you know. Instead of a job, it kind of turned into art. And I was never going to commit to anything that wasn't art-focused. Right. And then as soon as I realized that it was art-focused, you know, it kind of translates. Like nowadays, everybody that stages or works in the restaurant, I give them – you know, I sit them down to feed them just to make sure they understand what we're doing. It kind of – really struck a chord with me. I think I was probably 19 or 20.
And that's just getting the whole concept, not just the food, but the experience of how it's plated, how it comes out, how you feel when you're done mm-hmm. with the meal, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it just happened to be the best restaurant in the city at the time and probably one of the best that's ever been there. So I got treated really well, you know. So it was definitely like it blew my mind, you know.
When you think back to those days, I mean, being a 20-year-old kid, mm-hmm. and you've had, you know, you're now like just turned 36. Mm-hmm. To think where you're at, where you're in Chicago at a West Loop restaurant and with the names that were mentioned at the top, Food and Wine, Best Chef list of 2017, is it intimidating? I mean, to think that you're a part of such a culinary city that is worldwide at this point? I mean, the stars that come out of the culinary world come out of Chicago.
It's definitely, for somebody smarter than myself, would be very intimidating. But for me, I'm kind of just like, this is great, you know, and just... You know, I try to just stick to the basics, make sure that we're pushing forward, make sure that I'm there every day, make sure that we've got the right people in place. And then it's just kind of organic after that. If you try to force it, if you try to think about that kind of stuff and realize that Paul Kahn and Grant Achatz, I mean, what? Like, you can't start thinking about that.
I was just thinking, I had a mental image in my mind, like the minute you got the 4-star reviews and Food and Wine Best Chef list, that you went out and got like a sparkly suit,
oh yeah,
you know, with sunglasses, did the whole thing, and just your personality changed completely.
I did get a suit. It was blue. I had it tailored the day before I had to go to New York. I haven't worn it since, but...
We're talking with Chef Noah Sandoval. He is the chef at Oriole here in Chicago, which is getting tremendous reviews, 4 stars from Chicago Tribune and other places, as well as he being named to the Food and Wine Best Chef list of 2017, which is a big deal. All right, let's talk about the restaurant because it's a family affair. I love that that Food and Wine kind of called you and your wife and your friends the Fleetwood Mac of restaurants. This idea that the four of you, your wife, is it Kara?
Mm-hmm.
Your wife Kara and two friends who are also together, mm-hmm. married, went in on this idea. I mean, this idea to start a restaurant in Chicago, which seems like kind of the American dream, start a small business. But talk about that experience, and let's talk about the pros of being, you know, friends and family and working together at this restaurant, and then we'll talk about the cons.
But sure.
Let's start with the pros. What was it that brought you guys together, and what gives you an advantage to work with family and friends?
I've wanted this for a long time. She hasn't been in the business for that long. She's been in the business for maybe 4 years now. I've wanted this for, you know, 20, but she kind of adopted my vision and my like passions, which is, I'm very lucky to have that kind of support from her for sure. But we had Senza, and we had a stage at Senza who eventually became like my right-hand man. He was just kind of doing everything. Yeah. When we closed, we had developed a really good friendship, and he had started dating this girl. They hit it off. They fell in love really quickly, and she just happened to be, you know, in my opinion, the best pastry chef in the city. So when the opportunity came along to go to Oriole, when I was approached with the space and the concept, kind of, it was kind of a no-brainer. You know, we were sitting in a bar, and I was like, Tim, do you think Jeannie would want to come and do this project with me? You know, like maybe you could talk her into it or something. And he was like, yeah, I think she would do that. So it was really just kind of organic, just like here, you know, it just made a lot of sense.
Well, as much as, I mean, you're called out, obviously, for the list and for other things, you're called out. The restaurant is also called out. And they, you know, some go out of the way to talk about the successes, the four of you, the pastry chef, your wife as well.
Yeah.
Talk about how important it is to enter into a restaurant as a team.
It takes a lot of pressure off. You know, I could be fielding 100% of the pressures and the anxiety and stuff like that, but I'm fielding probably 25% of it. I'm a control freak. Anybody will tell you that. So is Kara. So we worked well together because she takes care of the front, I take care of the back. But there's always like checks and balances with Jeannie and Tim and even her. And there's a couple other, you know, key players. But I guess the main four people, it's everybody keeps each other in check and keeps each other inspired and just, you know, on the right path. You know, if I start to stray or if somebody else starts to stray, we just kind of see it really quickly.
What are the challenges of working? I mean, because someone's got to be in there in the morning. You're prepping for that day. You change your menu routinely. What are the challenges of working so close with family and friends? I mean, there's a great shorthand, I'm sure, but you guys get, like, is there a moment where, like, because you guys are close, it's easy to...
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, none of us really want to be rude to each other. But sometimes in a restaurant business, you have to be rude to somebody just to get a point across. We just all have so much respect for each other that that kind of gets in the way sometimes. Like if somebody's not doing something I don't want them to do, I'm not just going to be direct. I'm going to try to have this conversation, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And the same goes for them to me. It's a very unique kind of business model when it comes to that kind of stuff. And I wouldn't necessarily say it's a con, but it's kind of one of the only things that...
It's a challenge.
It's a challenge sometimes, yeah.
You know, you guys fall into the category of fine dining, right? I mean, you do. That's what Oriole does. What we know of it in Chicago, and when people hear that phrase, they think white tablecloths, and they might think of something that's intimidating, obviously price point, things of that nature. But you've kind of gone against that in a way that's not what you see fine dining to be. Talk about that. Talk about being lumped in as a fine dining restaurant with a lot of what the stereotype of what they think that is and what you're trying to change.
I think the best way to approach anything, whether it's musically or opening a restaurant or anything, is to kind of do what you feel comfortable doing and just do that the best you can do. And I don't feel comfortable in an uptight setting. I don't feel comfortable in a super polished room. You know, I feel kind of... Obviously, coming from my background, I'm not going to paint everything white and shiny, you know. I think that there's a lot of expectations with a lot of restaurants in the city, with fine dining restaurants, especially this price point that we do hit. Like, I think our service is impeccable, and I think that the food is exactly what I want it to be. Outside of that, I play the Clash in the dining room. You know, it's like, because that's what I want to hear. And if I try to listen to elevator music all day or like weird electronic music, I'm not going to be creative, and it's not going to be a reflection of who we are. Not to say that that couldn't be somebody else's, you know, but I think for us, it's just kind of sticking to who I am.
What do you consider when you say, you know, do something that you love or that you know and do it and do that, what you're comfortable with? What would you say your strength is? As an artist, as a chef, as someone who owns a restaurant, what do you think that you bring to the table? What would be the strength of Chef Noah Sandoval?
I think I'm aware of people's reactions, and I can read people's reactions pretty well, you know, and I take them seriously. I'm very flexible when it comes to things. If the diners don't like something, then I'm very, you know, focused on that. Or if the diners do like something, I focus on that. And the older I get, the more I do it, I realize that there are a group of things that I do that everybody seems to like, and there's some things that I try to do that maybe are a little out there, and that's kind of not, you know, I kind of call it the wheelhouse. Like, I've got this wheelhouse. If I go outside of that, I can see that people still like it, but they don't like it quite as much. So it's just kind of I adapt well.
That's a good answer. As we wrap up here, I'm fascinated with, you know, your story of wanting to be a musician, going all the way back to being a dishwasher in Richmond to now. where do you see yourself? I mean, is food your passion, or is it art? Could you, someone gives you an idea and they say, you know what, yeah. Noah, I think you're an unbelievable painter. Let's go over to the West Loop. Let's get you in a gallery. Let's do that. Yeah. I mean, where is the passion lie?
To say food would be an easy answer, but I think it's more of a orchestration of an entire restaurant. And I might be able to apply that to something else, but I'm definitely not brave enough to try that. But I know that I can do this well. For me, it's that. It's absolutely restaurant world.
So. There you go. Chef Noah Sandoval, the chef at Oriole. He was just named to the Food and Wine Best Chef list of 2017. And, of course, has so much accolades, including a semifinal, this nominee. Not a finalist nominee, which Chicago, we step up to that. I read many a story about how that was the snub of the James Beard, that Oriole did not get Best New Restaurant finalist. But that's okay. We'll look past that. We know that you're Chicago, and you're four-star in our heart. Yep. Chef Noah Sandoval, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Psyched for our next guest. This is a segment that's been in the works for about 6 months. I feel like, Ted came in, Ted McClellan, he's the author of How to Speak Midwestern. We talked about the book and where, it's a great book, get it if you can, because it's awesome. It explains where a lot of the accents from our region, the Midwest, came from. It really drills down on consonants and vowels. And then it also has a glossary, which I really like because it like explains some of the curious things that we say, like over there, where that comes from, things like that. So tonight, we thought we would do, and 630's got the best, he calls it, You Know What I'm Saying? It should be called You Know What I'm Saying? You Know What I'm Saying with Ted McClellan coming up, where you can call in. If you've got a thick accent and you're from a certain area of the Midwest, and I know you're listening tonight, because when we do swap meet, you know, inadvertently, I'm like, wow, all I want to do is talk about where that accent's from. When you say, I got this toy car, this NASCAR toy car. And I'm like, where is that from? But that's not the swap meet, right? We have to figure out what the value is of your junk, not where your accent is. So now you can call up, and then we'll ask you questions, and then Ted and myself will try to guess where your accent's from. And then the same with text. You can text in as well, glossary items. Like, I say, you know, over there, instead of pop, I see soda, you know, and we can try to figure out where you're from based on that. Be fun. And we got some stuff to give away tonight, too. 312-981-7200, the phone number, 312-981-7200. You can text that line or call coming up after 10 o'clock. Tomorrow's going to be an unbelievable day for me. I have the big show I've been talking about, LitFest. The LitFest show, I've got 5 or 6 authors on the show. We may have lost one today. David Levithan, who had done Nick and Nora. What's the, not Nick and Nora, the, anyway, young adult author, great author. And he has an emergency, so it may not be happening. And usually I'd be like, no!
Yeah.
But we have so many authors tomorrow. I'm like, yeah, you know what? I only got to about a quarter of that one. And that was like the hunker down book tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I'm actually like, well, you know, maybe I'd love to get him at some other point. We could talk to him. He's got a new book. He's a New York Times bestseller, and he's going to be at the book. I always want to call it the book fair. But
Chicago. You're from Chicago if you say book fair.
The Printers Row Book Fair. But yeah, so that's tomorrow night. Samantha Irby, Scotchy Cool. Mark Bowden.
Yeah. It's going to be great.
Ibram Kendi. It's going to be awesome. I mean, it's really is. Like, it's been a really intense week for me reading these books. Even tonight with Cory Doctorow. Like, it's just like a little point. Like, my eyes are glazing over. I'm afraid tomorrow I'm going to ask Mark Bowden, who did a great book, which I've been talking about for a week, the Hue book, Hue 1968, mm-hmm. about the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. In the Battle of Hue, I'm going to be like, so what's it like to write young adult? So tell me, Samantha Irby, you were in the Marines in 1960. I'm going to mess it all up. But just to add to it, and I thank my lucky stars on this, but I've been asked to do Chicago Tonight Week in Review. So I will be on with Lester Munson, Derek Blakely, and Dave McKinney.
Oh, great.
Wrapping up the week in news. And here's the deal, Pete. As you know, I don't do things. I don't do these half-assed.
No.
So last weekend, I went to Macy's and I bought myself, which was, you know, as for as much as everyone's talking about the death of retail, which is probably so, I was able to get a sport coat for like $100. So that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like a brighter blue sport coat and I got a pink shirt, like a hot pink shirt. The buttons are blue. Yeah.
Buttons are
it's
blue.
Cool. It's a whole striking outfit.
Good for you, Judge Smales. Nice.
Breaking that out first thing tomorrow.
So I've not worn it yet. It's the tags are still on it. And so listen, this is what I'm going to do. The first time it's worn is on television. How about that, huh, guys?
Mm-hmm.
No mess around. So it could be a fashion disaster.
That's reason enough to tune in.
Right?
Well, you tried it on, right?
I tried it on.
Oh, okay.
And my wife was like, it looks good. I'm like, does it? You know, I had that vibe. I'm like, really? I'm just not sure if this is my style. I don't know if I'm rayon material.
You're not going to clash against the set, are you?
That's the worry. Also, the other worry, Esmeralda, is most of the guys, they always wear ties. Now, they're dumb-looking ties, but, you know, there's going to be no tie in this outfit.
Oh, you're going cash.
I'm a little worried about your wife's response, though. Like most women, when we say they look fine, you should have turned the tables on her and say, well, good. What do you mean by good?
Yeah, right.
It's not better than good?
She says, this is sharp. This is a good look. It's a fashion-forward look.
Oh, well, then there you go.
Yeah, all right. I feel fashion-forward. There's no doubt. Like, the color scheme and everything, it's good. It's a good look. It's definitely, I mean, I'm on there with Lester Munson, who will have a black shirt and a red tie. You know?
that's his look.
Go, yeah. God love him, and he will be the star of the show. But I think that, you know, I'll bring like a little, like, umbrella, you know, so I look a little... Like a preppy umbrella or something like that to go with it?
No, I know no one's going to see this, but what's your footwear?
That's a good... I do have
I feel
options.
Like a loafer.
Yeah, I have a loafer at home.
Of,
I have
of
a,
sorts.
I have a cool new Tommy Hilfiger pair of shoes that I got from DSW, I'm not going to lie. They were on sale. But they look good. They got like stripes on the side, but I haven't been able to wear them yet. That's a good question. I got to figure that out. But you never see the footwear on the TV. I'm not going to wear
pants. I
feel
pants like you should go on afterwards.
Yeah.
Just kind of be like, I'm wearing this suit. Might as well.
Well, I'll wear it tomorrow to the show tomorrow night, too. And then see, you know, we'll see what the authors, the Lit Fest authors think of it, too. So it's a big fashion risk day for me tomorrow. All right. 312-981-7200. Hey, you know what I'm saying? With Ted McClellan up next. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's a 10 o'clock hour. I am very excited. This is something, like I said, has been in the works for a good 6 months, Ted. Wouldn't you say it's about 6 months we've been talking about this? I feel like we have.
At least. Ever since the book came out.
All right. In studio tonight, the author of the book, How to Speak Midwestern. In the book, Ted McClellan not only breaks down the elusive regional accents of the Midwest, but he also creates the ultimate glossary of terms used in the area, in our area. Phrases like hodag or over there or farty, which is the way people in St. Louis say 40. So here's the game tonight. We're playing for some prizes, 312-981-7200. Let's stump Ted. How about that? You can call in or you can text in. We can guess your regional accents through interrogation, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can text in with your saying or phrase, and we'll see if Ted can guess where you're from. Ted, great to see you. How you been, bud?
Oh, great. I've been traveling for the book. I'm going to be at the Printer's Row Lit Fest at the Belt Publishing booth on Sunday.
Up this weekend. That's great. Perfect.
Right around the middle of the day.
All right. 312-981-7200. You know, we had you on before, and I mean, you have become the foremost Midwestern expert when it comes to accents and dialects in this area. Talk about it, because when I think about it, I'm like, okay, well, there's Chicago.
Right.
There's Wisconsin.
Right.
Kenosha.
Yeah.
And I guess Michigan, but I never can pick up Michigan.
Okay, well, I can pick up.
All right, so why don't we start? I mean, how many, when we talk about this, how many do we?
Well, I mean, I kind of identify three main accents. Now, we're in what's known as the Inland North accent region, which stretches from Rochester, New York on the east to Milwaukee on the west. And these all correspond with patterns of settlement. This followed the Erie Canal and it followed the Great Lakes. And I think people would be surprised to find out that people in Chicago talk more like people from Buffalo than people from downstate Illinois. Somebody who read my book told me that they had heard a speaker and they said, this guy's got to be from the south side of Chicago. And they went and talked to him. He's from Buffalo. So they do the same kind of thing. They do the, you know, they do the D's, Dem, and Do's thing there. And, you know, they do the Rays Day where they'll talk about a can of pop. You know, so that's kind of, it's kind of the source of our accent is upstate New York. And then we got the Midland accent, and that's what you get in central Illinois and also St. Louis, as we were talking about. And the, you know, the signature Midland word is Warsh. And I play this when I do my presentation. It's Bob Knight, and he's endorsing Donald Trump, and he's telling the crowd, if you people go out there and vote for Donald Trump, they're going to put you right next to our founding father, George Washington. So he's
Washington,
from,
got it.
George Washington.
Okay, Washington, yeah. Right.
And there's a guy, right. Mike Shannon. Do you know Mike Shannon? He's the announcer for the St. Louis Cardinals.
Yeah.
He always talks about how they're playing the Washington Nationals.
Okay, so he's at least, it's always good when your announcers or your baseball team
right,
speak.
Have that
accent. St. Louis, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And what's the third one?
The North Central accent, the so-called Fargo accent, you know, which became famous through the movie and now the TV show. So you'll hear that in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. You'll hear it in northern Wisconsin. You know, if you watch Making a Murderer, the Avery family, they all did.
Right. I have to see if it's on my phone, but I had stopped off at a Kenosha car dealership because I got my headlight changed.
Yeah.
And then I thought nothing of it. Like, I was going up to see my parents, and I'm like, I'll do this. I'm right here, you know. And I got a call a couple days later, and it was from, like, a customer service rep.
Yeah.
And it was like, hey, this is Kathy from Kenosha.
See,
and I was like, I really thought it was like a – bit or something, but it was hardcore Kenosha.
Oh, sure. That long O, that comes from the Scandinavian language. I mean, immediately you cross the Cheddar Curtain and they start doing it right away. I mean, that's the first town over.
It's the first town over.
See, that's one word, that's one term that I regret leaving out of the book, which is, you know, the Cheddar Curtain, the Illinois-Wisconsin state line.
Right.
You go up north, you're behind the Cheddar Curtain.
Do you see, I mean, is it so strict to... to state lines? I mean, do people have...
It's interesting because I was driving from Madison to Rockford, which aren't very far apart, and I'm listening to the radio, and pretty much when I crossed the state line, it changed from the kind of a north-central accent to an inland-north accent.
Well, okay, so 312...
It's not strict.
It's not strict, but...
It's for straight line, because, you know, as you say... Northeastern Illinois has one accent, and then you know, Central and Southern Illinois have another accent. So it kind of corresponds to where people came from or where they settled.
312-981-7200. Let's see if Ted can guess your accent. If you're part of those three categories, and maybe we can even drill down with some interrogation to get a little closer to what town you're from.
Yeah.
Again, 312-981-7200. Ted's got he was a little trepidatious, you know. You wanted to back out of this. You were like, I don't know if I'm that good. And I'm like, come on, man. This is going to be a fun thing.
You know, there's a quiz that's on the New York Times website, and they ask you 25 questions about, you know, how you pronounce things, what words you use, and it'll get with almost pinpoint accuracy where you're from.
Yeah, but that's a computer. That's boring.
Sure, but I did it with... Okay, all right. I got to have the year, right? I did it with four people, and we're all from different parts of the country, and it nailed us exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we could do...
But we want to hear these. We want to hear these Midwestern accents here on WGN.
Absolutely, and we know you're listening, because the last time that Ted was on, I had a lot of people who reached out from different places, and we did the sort of... tell us where you're from, sort of check, a status check. And we got people from Iowa, Minnesota, from Colorado even. I mean, obviously the AM dial goes a far, far away until it hit the mountains east or west. So,
and we want to hear your terms. And I don't know, can we throw out a term and see if people can identify it?
Let's do it.
All right, see if anybody can tell me what burgoo is.
I love it. This is a classic. I love it. We're going to throw as much against the wall and see if it sticks. Ted McClellan, my guest. He's the author of How to Speak Midwestern. Let's take a quick break. We'll get people on the line, and we'll try it out. I'm excited, Ted. This is going to be fun.
All right.
Stay with us. This is Download on 720 WGN. Ted McClellan's in studio with me, and we are... we're having some fun. The calls are lined up, and we were worried, hey, you know, is anyone really going to want to play along?
Yeah.
And the lines are lit up, and the texters are they're on you with the Burgu.
Yeah.
They nailed it. Burgu 773 says Burgu is a stew from Kentucky, delicious. You say no, not necessarily.
Well, I have a Pioneer stew originally made with squirrel, venison, whatever vegetables the prairie's first settlers could grow. Utica, Illinois holds a Burgu festival, and they make beef, carrots, potatoes, hominy, celery, tomatoes, cabbage, onions, and peppers. They don't serve squirrel because it's legal to kill a squirrel and eat it yourself,
right?
But not to serve it to somebody else.
As we learned from Mike Sula in the Chicago Reader, he told us that whole thing. He did a big piece about that a couple years back. Won a bunch of awards. Yes, and Ed from Joliet got it. He said Burgu Game Stew, Utica, Illinois.
So yeah,
Utica.
All right.
Let's go to the phones. Let's see if we can guess some of the stuff. Let's go to Eric. Eric, how are you, my friend?
I'm pretty good. How are you guys?
We're good. So what do you want to do? You want to guess the stew, or you want us to guess your accent?
I'd rather you guess my accent because I have definitely never heard of Burgu before.
Okay. All right, good. Well, we got it out of the way. All right, so right off the bat, I'm like, okay, Eric, you sound pretty normal to me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so what is the first thing, Ted, that you would ask Eric to try and get?
I'd ask him what he calls a soft drink.
I call it pop.
Okay, I'd ask him what he calls athletic footwear.
Shoes. I guess gym shoes.
Okay. This guy's from Chicago. This guy's from the Chicago area.
Is that true, Eric?
It is. Well done.
Yeah, well, gym shoes. Only in Chicago.
Only in Chicago is gym shoes? That's a giveaway?
Yeah, for sure.
Wow, that was quick.
Okay. I can't use that one again.
Yeah, right. So can you get as specific, do you think, where in Chicago? Like, is it like a thicker accent on the south side or different on the north side?
It might be. You know, if it was a really old south side guy, I'm not hearing a super, I'm not hearing a firefighter from Mount Greenwood accent or anything like that.
Eric, where are you from?
I am from Carpentersville, Illinois, which is a far northwest suburb.
Okay.
Yeah, see, it's very nondescript, right?
But, you know, that's why I said, you know, let's use the words.
Yeah, love it.
That's what tells the story here.
Eric, thank you, buddy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You guys have a good night.
All right, good. All right, let's try Kathy. Kathy, all right, Kathy, I'm psyched. Thank you for calling in. I really appreciate it.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. All right, so we got some questions for you, Kathy. You ready?
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself first so we can hear you talk.
Well, I'm just fascinated with this topic, just to hear where all these different people would be coming from with their dialects or special words that would be only pertaining to them from where they came from.
Okay. I guess we could ask you a few questions. Maybe we can try to figure out what would you call a fountain that you drink out of?
Water fountain.
A water fountain. Okay, so you're probably not from Wisconsin here.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay, so we've eliminated
Wisconsin.
All right. What do you call a place where you buy a store where you buy alcohol?
A liquor store.
Okay, so you're not from Michigan.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
All right. This is great. All right. Do you know the name of a bicycle ride across the state of Iowa?
Ragbray.
Okay, so what do you call a sandwich with crumbly beef? You know, or here's another. Okay, this is better. What do you call a port-a-john?
I wouldn't know a port-a-john. Porta potty. I don't know.
So you're probably. I'm guessing you're not from Iowa then.
No, I am.
Oh, you are? Okay, well, maybe I should have said that because you got Ragbri right. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay, or Ragbri. All right.
Yeah, you got the first one, but you couldn't get her on port. What is the porta potty?
A Kaibo.
A Kaibo?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's an idea.
That's funny. I've never even heard of that.
Oh, okay. No. I've heard that, too. I won't hear that anyway. Okay, but...
Kathy, that was great.
But maybe that's, Western Iowa versus Eastern Iowa.
Sure. Just knowing Ragbri, I should have said, hey, that's Iowa.
But you were on the right track because you had Iowa and then you drilled down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was trying to say maybe she's heard of it, but...
Oh, too funny.
I'm trying to...
Too fun. Kathy, thank you. That was awesome. All right.
Okay.
This is so good. Sorry, right. I cut her off. Let's go to Mark. Mark. All right, Mark, you ready? Mark, you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, gentlemen.
All right.
Ooh. Hi, Mark.
Mark, tell us a little bit about yourself without telling us where you're from.
I'm an outside salesperson.
Okay. What is that? What do you sell?
I sell insurance products to pre-owned used car dealers.
Okay. Okay. So let's see. Let's try some words here. What do you call the narrow space between two buildings or houses?
A gangway.
All right. See, this guy's from Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good, man.
No doubt about it.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
We're okay.
That question was not fair.
It's not fair.
Mark, where are you from originally?
I was born on the west side of Chicago, and I now live in DuPage County.
All right, there you go.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, good. So you're getting him on these first ones.
He sounded Chicago to begin with, so that was
can
my,
you,
my first
can,
game.
I mean, so automatically.
The other woman did not sound like, she sounded a little bit northern. She might have been from northern Iowa.
Yeah.
So she didn't really sound urban.
And she definitely had a very different accent than
right.
what you might find around here. So
exactly.
That's kind of interesting. Oh, I love this. This is so fun.
Okay.
All right, we're getting a lot of texts, too. I want to get to them, but I will. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's get some more people on for the second half, right? I think we should. There's no doubt about it. It'd be too much fun. 312-981-7200. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back with Ted McClellan.
All right.
What are you saying, Ted?
All right.
All right, 312-981-7200, the phone number. We're having some fun tonight. Why? Because Ted McClellan is in studio. How to Speak Midwestern is the name of his book, and he is doing that for us tonight. I'm having a ton of fun with the new segment. You know what I'm saying? With Ted McClellan. As we went to the break, you gave a juicy Lucy, and we have some answers here. Someone says it's 847 says that Juicy Lucy is a beef dipped in juice.
No, that's not right.
That's not right.
No.
630 says it's a hamburger.
Yes, it's a hamburger.
That's all they say, though.
Oh, we need more.
And then 847 gets the winner. It's a hamburger with cheese inside of it.
Yes.
And there are two places that claim to be the originals of them. Jack from Gages Lake, Minnesota.
Right. In Minnesota, I saw a hamburger with a pool of melted cheese in the middle. Matt's Bar and Grill and the 5-8 Club in Minneapolis have a long-standing dispute over which establishment invented the burger and even how it's spelled. According to the Matt's website, the Juicy Lucy, which is spelled J-U-C-Y, was created when a local customer asked for two hamburger patties with a slice of cheese in the middle. Upon biting into this new molten hot burger, he exclaimed, "That's one Juicy Lucy," and a legend was born.
Ah, 630 says, "What rural area are you both from?"
What rural area are
they
we
said,
both
what
from?
What rural area are both of you guys from?
And okay, I'm from Lansing, Michigan.
Oh, there you go. Or Wonder Lake, Illinois.
Okay,
Chicago. As a Chicagoan, I was taught, "From where are you?"
From where are you?
Yeah.
Okay,
that's what you're supposed to say when you're like, "Where?" I always say, "Where are you from?"
Okay, but that's like up in Wisconsin. Let's say, how's by you?
630 says, "Have your host say the call in phone number 312-981-7200.
Did you say it like that the first time? Did they pick up on that?
Maybe they did.
Well, we talk about that. You know, right. I talk about that, about hundreds in Chicago.
Hundreds.
You know, I live 4000 North.
Yeah, right?
Right.
There's another one here that says 708, the Jewels.
The
yeah,
Jewels.
We get that. That's a Chicago thing.
That's, I think that's kind of becoming ironic.
Yeah, it's not.
It's kind of like French Room.
No one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. 708 says Garotchki.
That's what you open your garage with, right?
Oh, garage key?
Garage key. Open your garage.
Yeah, garage.
So you can go out and work on your engine.
There you go. 312-981-7200. Let's go to the calls. All right, Lucy. Lucy, you're up.
Oh,
Lucy, we're going to guess.
Which Lucy is this?
I was hoping you wouldn't come to me.
Oh, okay.
All right, Lucy. All right, we're ready. We're excited. I have Inspector Ted here.
Okay.
Inspector okay. Accent. All right, so why don't Lucy introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about yourself without telling us where you're at.
Okay, well, recently retired, well, last year, and I don't know. What do you want to know?
what
enough
you,
to try and
what
hear
did
your
you
voice.
Retire from?
I'm sorry?
Where did you retire from? What did you do before you retired?
Sales and marketing for a great company.
Okay.
Okay.
Which one? Can we say it on the
Hayes
air?
Hayes Mechanical.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm not trying to do that to guess where you're from. I don't know where Hayes Mechanical is from.
Okay. Great.
They're right in Chicago.
Oh, okay. Oh, so.
Oh, where from?
I think we gave it away already.
Where are they from?
They're from Chicago. But
oh, okay. Well, since, okay. Since we now know where you're from, we'll have to do something else. We'll have to,
no, I don't know if we do, though. Do Hold we? On.
No, that's not where I'm from.
Oh, that's not where you're from. Yeah. Oh, okay.
All right, Lucy, I think we're ready for it.
All right, so maybe we can go back to one of the early questions. What do you call a water fountain?
A drinking fountain.
Okay, so that might rule out Wisconsin.
Mm. What's next?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
I love it. It's like a choose your own adventure.
What do you call a place where you get alcohol?
Liquor store.
A liquor store. Okay. So that probably would rule out Michigan. How do you pronounce the name of the nation's capital?
Washington, D.C.
Oh, we got you. You're from downstate Illinois, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Ah!
You nailed it. Yeah. Wow. Look at that. Got you on Washington.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's Lucy.
That gets me bad in uniform.
Yeah. Uniform. Where so I used to live in Decatur. Are you from anywhere near there?
No, a long time ago, East St. Louis.
But perfect. Know. Yeah, you said, because we were talking earlier about Mike Shannon, the Cardinals announcer, who talks about how they play the Washington Nationals.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Lucy, thank you so much. That was so great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, have a good night, guys.
You too. Thank you. You too. All right. There we go. Good work.
Okay.
All right. Julia. Inspector Ted McClellan is on the case. Julia, all right, are you there?
Hi Julia.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, Julia, tell us a little bit about yourself without saying where you're from.
Oh, sure. I'm an executive chauffeur, so I'm driving around right now the streets of Chicago, and I think he's going to have a tough time with me.
Oh, okay.
Because does that mean that you don't have a specific place that you live? That's what I'm afraid of. Like, if someone says you can't, I'm like a military family, so we moved around.
It's something like that.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so do you have a place you consider your hometown or where you're from?
I do.
Okay, all okay. Right.
Yeah. Play off that. We'll play off that.
Okay, we'll go back to, you know, some of the things we've been doing to eliminate certain states. What would you call a fountain you get water from?
A bubbler.
Oh, you're from Wisconsin. Come on.
I was born in Wisconsin.
There you go.
Nailing it. Right.
I really thought it was going to be hard. Call answer. I was born in Wisconsin.
Okay.
Then we moved to Chicago in eighth grade. Then I went to high school in Minnesota. And then I graduated from college in Iowa.
All right. But you got that kind of northern accent. You're talking about high school in Minnesota. You know,
that's so good, Julia. Yeah.
So good. So when you went to high school, you came to high school here in the Chicago area?
No, it's confusing. We moved. Yeah, high school was in Minnesota.
Oh, okay. And did they think it was funny when you asked where the bubbler was?
Yes. And then the whole soda and pop thing. Like,
oh,
I still
sure.
call that pop.
Oh, yeah, of course. Pop. And you got to say it with the long O, pop.
Pop.
Not just pop.
Yeah.
Right.
Julia, thanks so much. That was great.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
All right, talk to you later.
I can't believe how great this is going.
I'm pressing my luck here.
You are.
Someone's going to stump me.
This is Vegas casino type stuff. Right. You got a run going. We're on a run. You're a whale. All right, 312-981-7200.
Okay.
All right, so let's do this. Let's give the calls are coming in fast and furious. They do.
Okay.
Once you say, I'll never be stumped, they want to stump you.
Okay.
All right. Let's give one text idea.
Oh, okay.
You know, from the book.
Somebody tell me, or you
tell us a phrase.
Okay,
and then we'll take a break. They can guess it on text.
Somebody can tell me what or where ooey pooey is.
Ooey pooey.
Yeah,
ooey pooey is the phrase that
ooey pooey is probably Bob Knight. That's probably they. More like how they say it down there.
Ooey pooey.
Ooey pooey.
All right, 312-981-7200. It's a download. Stay with us. Yeah, we're having some fun tonight. 720 WGN. Playing a new game called You Know What I'm Saying with Ted McClellan, Inspector McClellan. He is the author of How to Speak Midwestern. He's actually going to be at the Printers Row Lit Fest this weekend at the Belt Table on Saturday or Sunday?
Sunday.
And you also, you're going out on tour again, so you're going to be in, where are you going to be?
Let's see, I'll be in Princeton, Wisconsin on Saturday, 1 o'clock, and then I'll be in Charlevoix, Michigan next Tuesday, and a week from Saturday, I'm going to be in Farmington Hills, Michigan and Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay.
We have a Facebook page, How to Speak Midwestern, that has all the tour dates.
Right,
I'm going to be going to Skokie and Morton Grove, so...
All right, let's
cover the whole suburbs.
You're really doing it up. You're really diversifying your tour by doing Skokie and Morton Grove.
Right.
All right, so let's go to the Ooey Pooey.
Yeah.
773 says that sounds like an old school cartoon character.
No, it's not an old school cartoon character.
And 219 nails it with Ooey Pooey is Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis.
Right.
It's in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Right, and abbreviated, it's IUPUI. And read that as a word, and it sounds like Ooey Pooey. And I think some people there take exception to it. They
don't like that.
They say, well, nobody calls UCLA UCLA.
Right.
So,
all right, here we go. Let's go to the lines. Let's go to Kim. Kim, welcome to You Know What I'm Saying with Inspector McClellan. How are you?
Good.
All right, good. Oh, you're gonna be real tight lipped, aren't you?
Oh, okay.
All right, Kim. Where are you? Tell us a little bit about yourself without giving away where you're from.
I'm a graphic designer and have done marketing for the past 10 years.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Good. What'd you have for lunch?
Tacos.
Tacos. Okay. What'd you have for breakfast?
Yogurt.
Okay,
yogurt.
All right. Well, let's see. Kim,
you ready?
A few words.
You ready for a couple of questions?
Sure.
All right, here we go.
Okay. When someone shovels out a parking space and puts a lawn chair out to make sure no one else parks there, what's that called?
Breaking the law.
Oh, she may not be from Chicago.
All right, not from Chicago. That's a deal breaker right there.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's see.
Breaking the law.
I guess it's tolerated here.
Ah, you're really a law and order, Kim. You really like the law and order. All right.
Let's see here. Let's see. What do you call a store where you buy alcohol?
Liquor store.
A liquor store. That might rule out Michigan.
Okay.
Hmm. What do you call a sort of a sandwich with sort of dry, crumbly beef?
Made right.
Made right. Okay. Are you from Iowa?
No.
Oh, no. That's an Iowa term. Yeah.
Right is a crumbly beef sandwich?
Pretty much.
All right. I didn't know that.
Let's see.
That sounds lazy. Hey, let me get one of those Made Right sandwiches.
Right.
You mean Made Right? Okay, I'll make it right.
Yeah, we had it at our school cafeteria.
Oh.
Okay, well, let's try.
So you live in a state with schools.
Okay. So she's definitely not from Wisconsin. They don't.
Oh!
Okay, sorry.
All right, so it's not Chicago, it's not Michigan, it's not Iowa.
Let's see.
Can I do one?
Yeah, you can do one. Go ahead.
What do you call a drinking fountain?
A drinking fountain.
Right. Okay, so we already got someone on that one from Wisconsin. What do you call it when you go into make a right turn and then do a U-turn to turn left?
Oh, I don't have the word for it.
Okay, so you're probably not from Michigan.
Oh, wow, we've gone through them. Okay.
Let's we could try. What's the nickname for far southern Illinois?
Oh, don't know.
Huh. This woman's stumping me.
Yeah. I think though that
All right, here's another one. Okay. What's the room in your house or your flat that faces the street and you put all your nice furniture there and you go in there, only go in there when there's company?
Oh, the front room.
The front room, okay. Or the front room.
Okay, so we've exhausted our.
I guess I'll just throw out. I guess that you're from Illinois somewhere.
I lived in Illinois, but not originally.
Where are you from, Kim?
Wisconsin.
Oh,
see, that's
okay.
You know why I messed it up?
Okay,
because I went in there and I started messing with Inspector McClellan's techniques.
Yeah,
and I threw a drinking fountain in. I should have said water. I messed it up.
Okay, all right.
It's my fault, Kim.
We someone finally stumped us, so we can give away. We can finally give away a prize.
Yeah, that's right. Technically, Kim, do you want to go to the? I'm gonna put you on hold, and we got complimentary passes to the Sycamore Speedway this 2017 race season for families. Kim, I'll put you on hold. Thank you for playing. All right, let's keep going. Let's do Linda. Linda, thanks for calling in.
Hi, Linda.
All right.
Hello.
I'm excited for this, Linda. All right, Linda, tell us a little bit about yourself without telling us where you're from.
Okay, I'm a musician.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I give private music lessons, and I'm coming home right now from playing a show.
Okay.
And
are you on the L?
No.
Okay, so she's
in
not
the car.
Okay. All right. All right. All right. I'm just helping you here, Ted.
Okay. Okay.
All right. So okay. So what did you have for dinner tonight?
For dinner, I had a salad.
Or did you even have dinner? Or did you have supper?
Yeah, I gotta.
No,
get
I had dinner.
Okay,
I had dinner.
Okay,
dinner.
So you're probably not from Minnesota.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Let's. Keep
All right.
Going.
We can ask you. What do you call the night before Halloween when people either burn down houses or just play pranks?
The night before Halloween.
Yeah.
Is that Hallow's Eve? No.
Okay, so that's technical. So
okay.
Yeah,
well, I mean, but you know, people from Michigan have a word for that one.
Okay, so she's not from Michigan.
Okay. Let's see. What do you call a restaurant out in the country? It's got white tablecloths and they serve prime rib and fried fish and old fashions.
That's a supper club.
Okay.
Okay.
And what should you when you want to have a sweet old fashioned? What do you put in there?
Sweet old fashioned. I don't drink a lot of hard liquor.
Okay.
Is it cherry juice?
Vermouth? Sprite.
It's
Sprite, you know. What do you call a flaky Danish pastry shaped like a giant donut? You get it in
croissant. Croissant.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's kind of a Racine thing.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Let's see.
Ask me about the shredded meat. Didn't you have that question?
Oh, the crumbly beef.
And then a sloppy Joe.
Some people call it a sloppy Joe, but in Iowa they call it a made right or they call it a loose meat sandwich.
All right, I got it.
Oh,
I got it. You ready, Linda? Linda.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Linda. Today there was some serious testimony on Capitol Hill in the city of.
Washington.
Okay, so that's not a Midland accent.
Mm, I tried.
Okay. Well, we can go.
All right. You know, well, for
when,
time.
When someone from Ohio is talking about that school up north, what are they referring to?
A school up north?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay, so probably not from Ohio.
Okay. All right. No. So we're exhausting our what kind of music do you teach?
Clarinet and saxophone lessons.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So I know she's a Midwesterner.
Yeah.
I can hear it.
You can hear it?
But we're trying to figure out.
Where do you do you live where you originally grew up?
No.
Hmm. Where do you live?
I live in Oak Park.
You live in Oak Park.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Let's see.
Okay.
Well, what does it mean to walk beans? Do you know that one?
No.
Okay, that's weeding a soybean field. They know that. They know that in Central Illinois.
I do know. When I first moved here, and I would tell people I lived in Chicago.
Yeah.
I pronounce it Chicago.
Right. And did people say Chicago?
Well, but it's people here say Chicago, right?
Well, actually, it depends. I mean, the real old school pronunciation is Chicago.
Oh, it is.
Yeah,
okay.
Chicago.
Yeah.
I got made fun of for calling it that.
Yeah.
Well,
that
was
35 years ago.
are you from Wisconsin?
No.
No? Are you from Michigan?
Although I spend a lot of time there. No.
No?
Where are you from, Linda?
St. Louis.
Oh, man, I just didn't hear the St. Louis.
Well, we went with the Washington.
Yeah, we tried to get
it.
Oh, yeah. Well, the one that I could have gotten you on was, you know, the corner that's the opposite corner of a street. What is that?
The opposite corner of a street.
Yeah, you're standing there and somebody's on the...
kitty corner.
Oh, okay. I always heard... people in St. Louis told me they said caddy corner.
Kitty corner, and we drank soda.
Yeah, they definitely do that. Oh, that would have been a good one. Yeah,
soda? Missouri?
Yeah, that's Missouri, because they had a thing called Vest Soda or Vest Cola. So I could have said, you go 20, 30, and what's next?
40.
Oh, okay.
I love it, Linda, but you may have lost a lot of that St. Louis
I probably have. Yeah. And when I go there now, I think everybody speaks with a Southern accent.
Really? Interesting. How old were you when you moved up from St. Louis?
I was 18.
Okay.
Came here for college and stayed.
Right, right, Linda. Right, right.
All right, Linda, I'm going to put you on hold. You stumped us, so we got surprises.
Wait,
did
she say Missouri or Missouri?
Missouri.
Oh, well, see, that's kind of... There's a big debate about that. You know, it's sort of...
I know.
Supposedly urban says Missouri and rural says Missouri, and politicians will record ads for different markets.
Do they really?
Yeah, with Missouri. Yeah, and Missouri.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Because St. Louis just has this attitude about the rest of Missouri or Missouri that it's just this sort of hillbilly backwater. And
St. Louis is like the shining city on the hill.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. All right, Linda, thank you. I'm going to put you on hold. Thank you so much. Wow.
Thank you.
All right. 815, and I don't know what this was referring to, but he says Iowa calls it Beggar's Night. And I forgot Beggar's what we were Night. Talking about that would have come in on.
Well, there's something in Illinois called La Guyenne. Which is actually it's in a town called Prairie de Rocher, and it's been going on every year since 1722, and it's a French begging festival, and they go around and sing this song and sing carols, and now it's basically people them alcohol and they get wasted.
I think you're right. I think that was a Halloween, like they call it. Right. Iowa calls it Beggar's
Night. I was thinking Devil's Night.
Devil's Night.
Yeah, that's what they call it in Michigan, and it used to be infamous for house burnings.
Well,
in Detroit.
When we do this again, which we will. We got to get more Michigan representation.
Sure, we didn't get anybody.
No one from Michigan.
No, we didn't get anybody. See, what I was looking for when I kept asking people,
don't give it away.
Alcohol, I was looking for Party Store.
Yeah, Party Store.
Yeah.
Ted McClellan, the author of How to Speak Midwestern. He will be at the Belt Table at the Printers Row Lit Fest this Sunday. He's also going to be out on tour. You can go on Facebook and find the How to Speak Midwestern page for all the tour dates. And we got to do this again. We'll set it up. I think we got a winner here. Ted, it worked. It worked.
Yes.
All right, that's going to do it tonight. Coming up tomorrow night, a big Lit Fest show, lots of authors on. It's going to be fun. Patty Vasquez in the house. She is here. She's got her show coming up next. What do we got on the show tonight?
Senator Dan Katowski's going to join us.
Right.
Ken Jacobowski. We're going to talk a little bit about, obviously, the testimony this morning.
Yeah, right. Did you watch it live?
I did watch it.
Did you get up and watch it?
I set my clock for 5 minutes to 9 a.m. and slapped myself awake. And started watching it live. And then I went to a bar to watch the coverage afterwards.
Did you really?
Yeah, this is kind of... I was telling them last night, when I was like 4 years old, I was in front of the TV watching the Iran-Contra hearings.
Funny.
I was like, I don't know who that is, but he looks good in a uniform. Oh, he's going to jail. Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Right.
And then we're going to talk to Kel Mitchell from Kel and Keenan.
And
Kel?
Oh, great.
Yeah. So Keenan and Kel. Good Burger, all that stuff.
He's got the show on Nickelodeon that my son watches once in a while. I forgot the name of it, but it's fun to see him because I always go, oh, this is Keenan and Kel. And then hilariously, my wife doesn't like the show because it's a screamer show.
What's a screamer show?
It's it's a style where there's just so much energy and there's everything is like up here. How it is, and the kids and the kid, he does it, and it's just like, I don't mind it. I think it's funny, but it's like she's just like, she has a categorization for
it. When she listens to the podcast, tell her that we also have Steve and Johnny coming on.
Oh, cool.
Steve and Johnny
all
are coming
right.
in studio.
Good show.
So I feel weird because I feel like I'm just holding the place for them. So it's like, am I out again? It's all good. I'll see you tomorrow night,
all right,
Justin. Have a great night.